So we thought that because of the importance of what we're dealing with, it's important that we invite stakeholders to come and share with us their concerns, whether they're happy with the present deal as it is, what are their concerns, etc. So it's not only that we felt that we needed to invite you here. So without any waste of time, because we had a very long day, we are scheduled to finish it about 8 o'clock this evening. We'll have to start immediately. So could Mr. Samson and Mr. Maluleke, one from South Africa, London, from Beijing, South Africa, could both of you be done?
Yes, thank you, Chair. My name is Prince Maluleke. I'm with the Banking Association, which represents all the banks in South Africa. We, if you look at the program, we're supposed to present at 6 o'clock this evening. But we decided that if we save time and join in with one of our members, the Standard Bank. We've looked at their presentation, and it's actually, we were going to raise the same. We didn't want to repeat what they would have told you in the morning. The Banking Association, the reason we're here is that all these issues that are going to be raised affect all the banks. Standard Bank are not in a position to speak for all the banks, but we can speak on behalf of all the banks. And we appreciate this opportunity to utilize this opportunity, and Standard Bank has agreed to let us meet with them. With me, I have Doria Parsons from Standard Bank and Ian Simpson from Chapman and Wiley. Our submission today will focus on Chapter 4, Part 8, which deals with contaminated land, and more specifically how the bill will affect banking companies in South Africa. And we also make recommendations that we think can address our concerns. And I'll ask Ian to quickly go to the specific issues that we are concerned with.
Thank you, Mr. Maluleke. Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. As Mr. Maluleke said, the submission is really focused on one key area, and we'll limit our comments to that particular area. That relates to Chapter 4, specifically the contaminated land. Chairperson, we have prepared a slideshow, which unfortunately the IT system is not allowing us to put up, but before you'll hopefully have the slides, and I'll just take you through them very briefly, and hopefully other people who are here have them as well or can share them. Perhaps it's best to explain why a bank would be interested in the waste source. It doesn't obviously sound like an obvious area for banks to get involved in. And maybe the best way to do that is just to indicate one or two aspects of banking practice and then to explain how the bill's going to affect that. I think it's very commonly known, it's well known that all banks, in terms of their lending arrangements, very often require some form of security in order to protect the loan that they make to their particular customers, whether they be individuals or organizations or industries. And security can take a range of forms. And a couple of the ways in which the banks obtain security would be through bonds over fixed assets. And hopefully you can really hear where the bank's coming from as soon as we mention that. They become secured creditors, invariably over fixed assets, and that becomes their principal form of security going forward in terms of their agreement with their customers. There are other instances where the banks, particularly where they're entering into loan arrangements with large organizations, with large commercial industrial customers, will structure their loan agreements in such a way that it allows the bank to do what they call step in and take over and continue running these businesses where there's a breach in the loan arrangement or the customer becomes insolvent. That's one other aspect. There's also instances where they may acquire equity in a particular organization, or they may acquire a right to become involved in the management of a particular entity or a customer of theirs in their loan agreement. Now, those forms of security are going to be perfected generally where the customer's default in the agreements with the bank. For instance, they aren't able to repay their loan arrangements, they become insolvent, or they fail to comply with the conditions of the loan agreement in some other way. Where that happens, the bank then perfects its security in a number of ways. And there's two principal ways which we want to highlight this morning. The first is where the bank perfects its security over bonds registered over a fixed asset through a foreclosure proceeding. And not to waste this meeting's time in explaining that, which I think is a fairly commonly and a fairly well-known procedure. Effectively, the bank obtains a court order which allows it to take control of, attach, and to sell the fixed property over which it holds security. And the purpose of that is to... The purpose of that, if I can just scroll down to where we are, Chairperson. That's right. One more. Yes. Two principal ways in which the bank perfected security. The foreclosure proceeding is the first one. And as I've indicated in that slide, Chairperson, the principal reason for that is to recover the outstanding loan amount owed to the bank. The second way, as we've already alluded to, is where, in terms of its lending arrangements, the bank steps in or otherwise takes control of its customer's business and continues to run that business to a point where it's able to recover the outstanding loan amount either through sale of that business or through trading it out of its predicament. And again, as I've mentioned in that point, the principal reason for that, and the only reason the bank gets involved in that instance, is to recover the outstanding loan amount that's owed to it. Now, that being the banking practices that we are concerned about, there are several provisions in Chapter 4 which highlight several predicaments for banks if the provisions are implemented as they're currently drafted. In this slide, I've just highlighted what those provisions are, and we'll then explain in a little more detail in the next slide where they fit in. But specifically, we're concerned about the retrospectivity of these provisions. Not in principle. We understand the logic behind asking people who cause harm retrospectively to deal with it, but from a banking practice perspective, there are some real concerns about that. Secondly, there's a concern with respect to the obligation on landowners or people in control of land. We have a positive duty to determine whether their land is contaminated and to then report it to the relevant official. Thirdly, the directives that the officials can issue to undertake site assessments, and where these site assessments determine that there is contamination, there's also concern with respect to the remediation orders which may be issued to address the situation. And then a particular concern relates to the limitation on the transfer of designated remediation sites in terms of Section 40 and the contaminated land register where these portions of land are going to be described once they have been declared remediation, in fact not remediation sites but investigation land. So if we keep those provisions in mind, Chairperson, some of the consequences, if we go back to the banking areas of banking practice that we're concerned about, foreclosure and stepping in and taking control of customers' businesses, and applying it to the provisions that we face with. In the first instance, we're going to find that banks, the minute this act is promulgated, are sitting with a whole lot of land over which they are secured creditors, which is going to already classify itself as contaminated land or land requiring some form of remediation. And the obvious impact of that on the banks is that security is going to be prejudiced, it's going to be compromised, and its value is obviously going to diminish immediately. Because firstly, transferring the land once it's declared remediation land is going to become difficult, and secondly, there's not going to be too many takers in terms of buying contaminated land, I'm sure. So there's an immediate impact for banks the minute that provision is implemented. Secondly, where the banks find it necessary to protect their security, and starting firstly with foreclosure proceedings. The concern, particularly around Section 40, Chairperson, is that although the latest version of the bill has addressed the earlier concerns of the bank, the earlier version of the bill prohibited the transfer of land without the minister's permission. The current version of Section 49 merely requires the bank to notify the relevant official that it wishes to transfer the land. And for that reason, we put in brackets freely. And our concern is that it's going to limit or inhibit the bank's ability in the foreclosure instance to transfer that land to a third party. Keeping in mind that the banks in those instances are very anxious to sell the property in order to recover outstanding loan amounts. the procedure prescribed in Section 40 will require them to notify the officials and to then comply with any stipulations that those officials may have before they would be entitled to transfer that land. So at a practical level, we believe it's going to prevent banks from transferring land freely on foreclosure. The second sub-point under that, the second bullet point of concern is that where the bank needs to step in and take ownership of land that it forecloses on, it's in an invidious position if this bill is implemented as it is, because effectively it's going to step in and become responsible for having to address the contamination that may sit on the land. And once again, the banks are going to be left with either foregoing their security or stepping in and having to comply with these very onerous provisions which are set out in Section 36.5, 37.1b and 38.2. That's on the foreclosure side. In other instances where the banks, in terms of their structured transactions or their lending arrangements, are entitled to step in, take control where their customers aren't able to trade their businesses satisfactorily. And again, I emphasize that they only do that where they want to protect their security and recover the outstanding loan amount. Once again, they're left in an invidious position because they're then going to be faced with stepping in and having to comply with these very onerous provisions that attach to people who own or who are in control of land which is contaminated. The consequences of this are what are commonly known, commonly referred to Chairperson as lender liability. Now, from a recommendations perspective, Chairperson, the bank, first and foremost, I think must be stressed, is not seeking a blanket immunity for banks in all instances. And as the second bullet point, we try to stress that it's fully understood that where banks own land or where they operate from land, and banks are involved in a range of business activities. They don't just do purely banking activities from land. They may own or operate development sites where, for housing development, for example. It's fully understood that in those instances, the banks will be like any other citizen and will be required to comply with the onerous provisions of this particular chapter. However, what the bank is what the banks are asking, a chairperson, is that in those specific instances where only foreclosing on land, taking ownership of land, or trading a business out of a financial predicament, purely to protect its security, that some level of protection is afforded to banks in those particular instances under the bill. And that's really the petition which is being put forward now. And as I've set out in those two sub-bullet points under the third bullet point, we must be kept in mind that in these instances where the banks are foreclosing or setting in, they haven't caused or contributed to the solution in any respects at all. They're purely taking over from their customers, and either the customers or their predecessors would have been the direct cause of the solution which they now face with. And secondly, as I've emphasized already, they're only doing this for one purpose only, and that's to protect their interest in recovering the loan amount. Now, there's precedent in foreign law, Chairperson, for governments having already recognized this predicament which banks face. And as I've mentioned in the first bullet point, there are several jurisdictions which have introduced several protections under their legislation for assisting banks in terms of addressing contaminated land issues. I've set out three examples there, and there are others, but just for the purposes of this short presentation. Firstly, at a European Union level, in their white paper on environmental liability, which all of their member countries then need to implement through their national legislation, they've determined that where banks do not exercise operational control over their customers' business through their lending arrangements or where they step in and take control, they will not be held liable for addressing contamination in those particular instances. In the United States, which really started the whole issue around lender liability back in the 1980s, they, by 1996, had realized that their contaminated land legislation had gone too far. And what you were finding is that banks were automatically becoming the fall person and were being held accountable for addressing their customers' contaminated land issues. And as a result of that, in 1996, they implemented the Asset Conservation, Lender Liability, and Deposit Insurance Protection Act, which defines and limits a bank's responsibility where it is simply exercising its right to protect its security in a particular transaction. And they do that in two ways. The first, through foreclosure proceedings, they specify that where the bank is foreclosing and taking ownership purely to protect its loan interest, and it doesn't delay in transferring that property onto a third person, the bank would be excluded from liability in those particular instances. in the second scenario that this Act also protects banks by specifying when and how they will have taken sufficient control of their customers' business in order to attract liability. And it's only in those instances that the banks would be held accountable for addressing their customers' contaminated land. In all other instances, they would be excused from liability. So on that basis, we've put forward several recommendations. And we do that firstly because there is no similar legislation to the foreign legislation which we've highlighted now in South African law. In fact, most of our contemporary environmental legislation affords banks no protection whatsoever. We think of Section 28 of the National Environmental Management Act and Section 19 of the National Water Act. The breadth of liability and the pool of responsible parties there is extremely wide and potentially would attract liability for banks as well. The reason for making these recommendations is that if government doesn't come to the assistance of banks, you can understand that banks are going to have to rethink the way in which they go about their lending arrangements. Because if your secured asset isn't going to be worth what you believe it is, or if you're going to attract more liability than you are owed on your outstanding lending arrangements, well then it's going to be unlikely that banks are going to want to take that form of security to fix the asset. And it may well affect the instances in which they will advance loans to particular customers. That will obviously prejudice banks, and consequently will also affect the economy in terms of making finance available for ongoing development. The other point to stress before I mention the specific suggestion is that we have the benefit of hindsight now. We've learned from a foreign experience. Banks overseas, where legislation, very similar legislation to what we are proposing to introduce now, was promulgated, we can see the impact which it had on banks. And with that benefit of hindsight, I think we'd really be remiss if we didn't take the opportunity now, while we're developing a very important piece of legislation, to try and address that situation and avoid us having to encounter similar problems for banks as they faced overseas. So with that in mind, we put forward a couple of suggestions in terms of amendments to the current version of Chapter 4. These words are probably more verbose than they need to be, but it's really we put it in to try and more indicate the nature of the protection that the bank's looking for, and obviously the drafters of the legislation could refine this as they felt necessary. But the first suggestion was to amend Section 40 by the insertion of a new Section 40 subsection 2. Essentially, it would provide a limitation on liability by using the following words: providing that the obligation to notify the Minister or MEC and complying with any conditions that are specified by them will not be applicable in those instances where a secured creditor seeks to transfer the contaminated land for the purposes of foreclosure proceedings, and with the proviso that such transfer takes place expeditiously and solely for the purposes of recovering any outstanding loan amount. In the second instance, we suggest an amendment to Section 39, again adding in a new Section 38(3), and once again very similar lines to limiting the instances in which banks would be responsible for addressing contamination, with wording along the lines of provided that a remediation order issued in terms of subsection 2 may not be issued to a secured creditor who has acquired ownership or control of the land solely for the purpose of foreclosure proceedings, but only where the transfer of contaminated land from the secured creditor takes place expeditiously and ownership or possession is held solely for the purpose of recovering any outstanding loan amount, with a further proviso, and importantly, that the secured person has not contributed in any respect to the contamination which may exist on the land. If that wording isn't appealing to the draft of the legislation, then our appeal is really to then, in the alternative, ask that the drafters consider the following three amendments. Firstly, to clarify in the final version of the bill that no operational control of a customer's business does not affect liability for lenders. So where they purely step in or they foreclose, but they have no direct operational control, that shouldn't affect liability, and we ask that be clarified. Secondly, we ask that the bill defines the activities that lenders may perform over a customer's business that will or will not attract liability for them. And thirdly, we ask that some level of protection is afforded to lenders during foreclosure proceedings in a similar vein to the way in which they've protected banks in the United States and other jurisdictions. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Could I invite comments from members?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your presentation. First, one would like to say that we all know, it's common knowledge, that the Constitution in South Africa guarantees almost each and every citizen very clean environment. Number two, we all know, long before Industrial Revolution, that land was not contaminated. Contamination is man-made. So therefore, it can be dealt with by man. It can be resolved by man. Now, I would like to know from you, as you say, as a banker, if you were a potential customer to a banking institution, and you wanted to borrow money to secure a piece of land, would you be willing to buy a piece of land that you know is contaminated? The second question is, who do you think should be responsible for a piece of land that you have financed, and the person who happens to be the mortgage holder, if he contaminates that land in the process? Because I think somebody has to be held responsible for their behavior. For a long time in this country, we really were not very careful about what we do in pursuing financial gains. Okay. Because I can clearly understand that the bank has an interest. It has borrowed money out and it wants to make sure that its investment is secured, so that if I'm not able to meet my mortgage obligation, then you can foreclose. And once you foreclose, then you're in a position to liquidate and then regain your money again. But now the problem then becomes when someone buys that piece of land. Don't you think that perhaps maybe the best way of dealing with the situation, it is perhaps looking at a piece of legislation that would somehow be in a position to deal with financial institutions' concern? So I've asked you quite a number of questions, so I hope you'll be in a position to respond to that. Thank you.
Thank you,
Dr.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. I think I understand the concerns as have been put in this presentation. You probably may not want to share this, but any kind of impact study or initial study on the effects that such a piece of legislation might have on the banking sector, firstly. Flowing from that, could you expand on using your example from the European Union and the United States on the effects that similar legislation had there on banks, and possibly linking that to obviously your business model and how that may have been might be transferred in terms of costs onto borrowers. And my last question is, understanding that one of your desires is lender protection, how do you see, let's say that was guaranteed, that was granted, and that was amended. How in your mind would then the rest of the bill affect the running of the banks in terms of how you grant loans in the future to land which you presumably through assessment might know that that it is contaminated. I would think that even if lender protection was guaranteed, there will be costs to the bank anyway, which I guess you might pass on to the borrower. But in terms of assessing the actual land before you work out the amount of money that you're prepared to offer to the potential buyer. So I guess there are issues then as well when the bank knowingly finances land that is contaminated. Thank you.
I think I'm covered by Mr. Morgan's question. I also wanted to know what the... It's very interesting because it's not something that that I've really had realized that you know, what the impact could be on the banking sector. And I would like to know, is the bank at present in possession of having foreclosed on in the possession of contaminated land? I mean, do you find yourself in a situation now where you sort of retrospectively are in a tricky position because you have foreclosed? I imagine it's mainly in the mining sector where there is land that is historically contaminated and yet in quite valuable parts, particularly, I imagine, up on the reef and in Johannesburg and Pretoria. And do you see that for the future that there will be that it will put a damper on the property market? I mean, I think that it's certainly going to be a huge deterrent, hopefully for in the future for people to be tremendously much more careful about contamination, because it is going to devalue property and has done. But just from a history point of view, what are we looking at is it large numbers of land that are going to find themselves without a buyer, and will you then be find yourself just very, very hesitant about becoming involved with any sort of loan that might put your bank at this sort of risk? Yeah, I'm sorry, I haven't really thought it through very clearly, but I think it's very interesting.
Yes, that's a very quick point. Number one, it's appreciated the interest expressed by the bank in the waste management deal. Was one would not expect keenness of participation from that sector. But it does show that there's a lot of public consciousness from the banking sector as far as the issue is concerned, in respect of environmental issues. Although we know it is the bank that is definitely in the sense of altruism, it's just an interest to protect the mine, but they should get the credit for that. So that's number one. Number two, banks are known to subject applicants who borrow money to rigorous due diligence. Is it not the responsibility, therefore, of the bank themselves that when an applicant comes, they must say, look, they must then conduct the EIA and everything at that stage, and not burden the, not rush to lend, and then impose the responsibility to the legislator that you must now be free as we the bank from effects of contamination when we've already approved the loan and process to the Vietnamese application. So I think the bank has got the responsibility that during the process of application to have to be drawn into the responsibility arena of the EIA to say, is the land that you're buying free of any contingency, etc., and then get all the experts to back up that application instead of passing the responsibility to the legislature. That's scenario number one. Scenario number two, where I think sympathize with the bank, if the bank has financed a piece of land that is free of contamination, prima facie, but then contamination ensues during the course, and then when there's foreclosure, and then the bank tries to recover that piece of land and find that they cannot sell it because it was a pristine piece of land clean, but then got contaminated after the fact. That is where now I think the bank can fix remedy. But the point, the thrust of what I'm trying to say is that now the bank cannot shift the responsibility of absolution to the law. They must themselves to the people that come to the party to do the details and make sure that they are environmentally conscious when they process that in the first place. It's sort of really looking at the fact that the person is bank is credit worthy and say, fine, your balance sheet is okay, you're a very strong person, you want that chocolate, take it. And then when it's contaminated, no, when ask the politician, you know, to rescue his asset from liability.
Thank you. Bueno, Manzana.
Chair, thank you very much. Chairperson, I understand the fears of the banks where people want to lend money for improvement. Now, Chair, although some of our members have already said something about the money, but what I would like to ask is, where a community, especially in rural areas, find themselves already in that position where the miners came in, dug big holes, leave the holes open, and it's just a huge field that the people would have used to produce something there. Something that you would. Now, it is not the responsibility of those people that those mines were set up. They were done during the previous regime. That wherever there are valuable metals in the ground, or prospectors can come in, dig out whatever they want, go away, and leave that that land open. And what if those people would like their land to be productive again? Maybe they want to build something there. Although I'm speaking about people who have been even driven out of their land so that they must make way for mining. And then mining which was done by any other person, as long as you are the right color, then you can go and mine there. And now they are left with all those homes. What happens if those people want to borrow money, they want to build make a better life for themselves in their land? Is the bank going to reject them? I understand your fears, the fears of the bank, but I also would like to know what is the position with such communities, because they did not put themselves in that position. They find themselves there with all those holes, and in those holes There is a danger of people going right down saying, maybe we'll get diamonds and then becoming scratch, and the world come down onto them and injure them, and it has happened. And sometimes even animals falling there, they get hurt, they die in there. But now, as dangerous as they are, what if people want to make good use of that land, but they've got no power? Are the banks going to reject them because of something that is not their fault? Chairperson, thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the presentation. Some of the issues that I wanted to ask have been covered. More particularly, what was said by the Honorable Mukwena, because one of my questions was that do the banks have any framework, anything in their framework to protect their clients on the issue of contamination of the land, or the banks are looking at only the value of the land and the devaluation of the land and sort of are only sort of securing them only themselves, as to say nothing should implicate the value of the land, but having not maybe put something on issues that are environmental related. But that's what I wanted to really do. Thank you.
Of course, could have a response to this question.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the questions. There's obviously a number of questions, and I'll try and answer them very quickly and maybe cover a lot of them in a single answer if that's possible. I think if the point didn't come across in the presentation, we must emphasize the bank is asking for a very, very narrow level of protection. We're not trying to water down the bill in any respect. We fully understand the importance of addressing contaminated land, past, present, and future. All the bank's trying to say is in those instances where we are purely exercising our rights as a lender in order to protect ourselves, don't then use us as the target for recovering or addressing the contaminated land, where we haven't contributed to the contamination and all we're trying to do is secure ourselves. I think the gentleman at the back really mentioned, who would buy the land. The market forces are quite strange, Chairperson. One person's contaminated land is another person's opportunity. And what the bank is asking for is just that it is protected in that procedure from transferring the land from its customer to a third party who are going to that transaction knowing full well that he or she would acquire that land with the responsibility to remediate it and take the necessary steps. And there was one of the questions was to try and highlight a couple of examples where banks have been caught out in these circumstances. If I can make it as brief as possible, and we use the United States as the obvious example, they had a piece of legislation which is colloquially known as CERCLA. It's got a very long title, which we don't need to set out for these purposes. But effectively, that piece of legislation was very, very similar to our Section 28 of NEMA and to the provisions that we want to implement in this present bill. Effectively, they said that if you were the owner of land or person in control of land, you became responsible for addressing it. Whenever you acquired that land or took control of it, so you may acquire it and the contamination exists, you would become responsible. What we found, what happened in the United States, Chairperson, was that because they hadn't limited the liability of banks, the minute banks foreclosed, or the minute they stepped in, keep in mind banks generally are only stepping in where their customers can't pay. So what the authorities were doing was were looking and saying, well, we're not going to get any money out of the polluter. And keep in mind the polluter is actually the offender in this instance. Because they couldn't recover money from the polluter, they were waiting until banks foreclosed on these pieces of land and took control of them, or stepped in and carried on trading the business. And there are a number of reported cases in the United States where banks were then held liable for having to pay for the contamination and for rehabilitating those pieces of land. The point was made that shouldn't banks fiscally responsible, where they go into lending transactions and they ask a lot of questions and they do due diligence on their customers. It's become more recently normal practice for banks to ask those questions and to identify where they believe their customers are going to cause harm. And there are a number of instances where banks nowadays in South Africa won't grant loans where they feel dissatisfied with the environmental risks associated with a particular project. So I think the point is a good one, and banks are performing that sort of due diligence on their customers and will do so going forward. And we'll try and stay away from those transactions, because keep in mind, as is already mentioned, if these are contaminated lands, devalue immediately. So banks aren't interested in getting involved with customers who are going to cause significant harm, because besides harming the environment, it prejudices their own commercial interests as well. So I think that is an important point, and the bank takes it on. And I emphasize again, the banks aren't asking for any protection where the bank itself causes any harm or contributes to the harm directly. Where banks trade in circumstances and they allow contamination to occur, they will face the same duties as any other individual or any other citizen in this country. It's purely in those instances, those very narrow instances, where banks are simply protecting their security through cover outstanding loan amounts and passing the land or the business on to a third person, who will then take over that responsibility and will continue to comply with the provisions of this Act in this particular chapter. The concern is that if we don't do that, what you're going to have is exactly what happened in the United States, where South African banks are going to become the easy target. Everyone knows banks have got money, or believes they've got money, and why not break the banks with the properties, because we then know we've got a short pocket to address the situation. Keep in mind that government struggles to deal with the contaminated land issue because it's often a finance issue. Remediating land can run into millions and millions and millions of rand, and government doesn't have an open wallet to deal with that. So it's obviously looking for responsible parties to deal with it, quite rightly so. The people who caused the harm must be held responsible for it. But what we're concerned about is you're going to allow a party who isn't really directly responsible for the harm at all, and who simply happens to move into your site for a short period when it forecloses or it deals with an insolvent customer, and they're going to get nailed with having to deal with these very onerous provisions. So it's that very narrow area of protection. I don't know if I've answered all the other questions adequately, but hopefully that makes the point that or the point that you raised in the question time.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Humphrey. But if we need you and invite Dr. Lotka and Mari Lu, I just want to ask this question. Firstly, what is the percentage incidence of this phenomenon in the Benina of you being located in toxic land? What is the percentage? We need to get a sense of what are we talking about here. Secondly, two banks and maybe the second council could comment on this. Do you have a clean oversight unit, a clean development oversight unit? Because as we get into the 21st century, you cannot undertake a business as we did in the past 200 years. We've got to take issues of environment firmly and fundamentally into our world. Is there such a unit? Do you have a question for the instead of saying this to? Which of your properties are likely to have environmental implications, etc., etc.? Do you do that? Or are you just saying that, protect us, we have no right, and the only one, just ensure that it's our bottom line, otherwise, it's business as usual?
Okay. No, as a banking concern, we don't have such units, but banks individually have equal rules to look after environmental concerns, and Doria here from Standard Bank is part of the job at Standard Bank to look at these issues. So all the banks would have individual plans or units.
Your first question, Chairperson, no, the study hasn't been done, as far as I'm aware, of what percentage of bank health security will be faced with this risk. It's again looking at past experience overseas with very similar provisions. That tells us that there will be a fair number of portions of land that are going to fall into this particular concern. So yes, we don't have statistics to provide you. Keep in mind as well, these laws are very contemporary in South Africa, so the implementation is still new. But with the emergence of the enforcement arm of these, I've no doubt that we'll start seeing these issues emerge more and more. And it's really, we're trying to prevent the problem before it happens, with the benefit of hindsight of what's happened over the years.
Can you comment on this audit? Do you really do an environmental audit of your property? Potential environmental implication of your property portfolio?
Mr. Chairperson, I'll certainly produce, I'm Gloria Parsons from Standard Bank. Projects where we do environmental impact studies, especially when it is a big project with finance implications for the bank, which Ian here alluded to earlier, that the bank will certainly step away when they find that the impact will be negative. However, as we all know, we mentioned now, we haven't done particular studies to see whether we actually are in possession and involved with transactions where the bank or where the land is actually already contaminated. That study still has to be done. I just want to say that certainly from Standard Bank's side, and I do believe from all the other banks in the country, we absolutely believe that every bank should have a very strong environmental risk unit to look after this kind of issue. And at the moment, the audits, unfortunately, are limited to those bigger projects, where the impact upon the smaller customer, person who's gotten his house or piece of land to offer as security for a loan if he wants to expand his business, there certainly we have to improve our controls and have to look after the customer as well. And I realize the concerns of the lady here in the second row, rejecting customers is certainly not what we are looking to. We would like to just be part of environmentally friendly business, and also looking after the customer in the sense of assisting them at the loan stage to maybe find out whether there will be environmental impact. The smaller customer needs to be included. I agree.
Okay, thank you very much. It might encourage us to agree with you if you also see that you're taking environmental steps. It might be a quick protocol on this question. And then the central advisor, maybe you may want to comment on this, the implication of this, if we're to consider this, what are there any fundamental implications of the legislation?
We'll do that, Chairman. I don't know whether you want me to comment right now, but we'll cover it, all the submissions, yes.
Thank you very much. Could we now invite the Habitat Council as well as Business Unity South Africa? We'll start with the Habitat Council and immediately with the so that we can manage time. Thank you very much. Madam Ruth, the friend of the committee, how are you today?
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to take part in the hearing. I'm afraid I have a rather tedious submission because there's so many points I felt obliged to touch upon, and I must just say that the Deputy Director General said that there was adequate consultation with NGOs and everybody, but two points I must just make. The one is, when they had the workshop in Cape Town, I phoned Pretoria, I phoned the province to find out when was it, and I didn't get an answer. They said they'd let you know and this and that. Eventually when I was again phoned, they said, oh, it was yesterday. So we couldn't protect. There were only a few people there. People didn't know. Now, if Department of Environment is anxious to get the input from the environmental organizations. They have the address of WESA in every part of the country. If they send that notice just to that one central point, WESA would let us know. So I'd like to appeal to them to do that in future. The other thing is that she also said that when submissions were dealt with by their department, they prepared a response report on which points they took and why they didn't take others and so. Now, none of us NGOs ever saw that report. And the points we made in our April submission, that was a January published thing that we had to have in by April, are not reflected, our suggestions and our queries and our worries, in this present submission. So that's why I just have to plod through many of the same points that we submitted in April. Now, I would like to say they are treated in this act, which we welcome and which are good and sound. For example, we're very pleased that it's taking account of cumulative effects, particularly in the issue of licensing. Forgive me, I still haven't had that eye operation. So I'm pleased for that.
You're spending too much time in Parliament.
I'm burning up my eyes with all the legislation here. And then also that there's an explicit suggestion that incentives and disincentives be introduced. I think it could go a long way to encouraging better practices in the country. But now, the rest of my paper, which is, as I say, too long, I would have liked not to be so long, concern things that we are so worried about. Now, the first issue I'd like to talk about is the matter of principles. I know that in Section 5 it says that the NEMA principles must guide. The word used is guide the interpretation of this Act. But as you know, this is now the first waste bill we have. And I think it deserves that it states its own principles clearly. It can take them over from NEMA, or otherwise it must state that the NEMA principles will bind the interpretation of this Act, that they are bound by it, not just guided by it. That doesn't seem to me firm enough. The other thing is that also, if this is supposed to be considered as a framework, then I would suggest that there should be a section stating the policy of this framework. Because the principles and the policy must, as it were, place this legislation. I'm not going to read everything that I heard, but the two principles that we're very concerned about, the first is the precautionary principle. Now, as Mr. Rita said, I've been with the committee and the portfolio committee for long years, particularly when we first worked on NEMA. Those of you who stood in the committee from that time. And in the very first, in the initial form that NEMA went to the Council of Provinces the term precautionary principle was used. That's an internationally recognized and very strong principle, which even states that even if something is not scientifically proved to be negative, but there's a likelihood that it might be, then the precautionary principle must kick in. It's much stronger than what we have now, risk-averse and cautious approach. And for something as important as waste, where we have such severe pollution dangers, I would like to see that principle be called by its proper name again. And then also the principle of duty of care. It is deeper in the draft that we have in the brief. It is mentioned, but it should be right up front. Duty of care and precautionary principle for the application and interpretation of this Act. Now, then I've spent a long pages about the definition of the word recovery as it's used in this bill. I have to read that to you. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. In chapter 1, in the definition, it is defined as recovery means the controlled extraction of a material or retrieval of energy from waste to produce a product. Now, I put it to the house that these are two conflicting concepts. The one is much to be applauded practice in waste management, that you extract or you obtain from material such value as you can. The other is this destructive process of the burning of waste to create a little bit of energy. And it's a practice which worldwide environmentalists are trying their best to bring to the realization of people how destructive and negative practice that is. You'll notice that I have spent the whole of the rest of this long section 2 on plotting in the act where this word occurs, and nowhere does when it occurs, it doesn't make the distinction. Are they talking about the negative sense, the energy from waste, or are they talking about the extraction of material, salvaging of worthwhile material as a resource? 2.2, I've said that, you know, it has been used in a positive sense in the preamble of the bill. I take it that it is. You can see I quoted these whole passages. I'm not going to read them all, but it occurs in the preamble. And this is a waste bill, so I take it that this is then positively as good waste practice as you can have. Then also in chapter 1, the section called General Duty of the State, I assume that it's also there used in the sense of salvaging of worthwhile material from waste. And then in chapter 8, General Matters, we have the ministers being authorized to make regulations. Now, section 69.1L2, it says the reduction, reuse, recycling and recovery of packaging. Now here too, from packaging, I take it that this would be salvaging. I'm not sure. The bill does not distinguish. Is it burning packaging to get a bit of electricity, or is it using again what you can and so forth? I must point out that in the whole rest of the bill, wherever they use this, you know, reduction, reuse, recycling, there's the word recovery each time, and we don't know how to interpret it. And then in the memoranda at the back, it's appended to the bill. Again, we have the word coming in there. You see, retrieval or recovery, extraction, is a important feature of good waste management, while burn technologies are not environmentally sound. Whatever the sellers of these technologies claim, there are great efforts throughout the world to fill these waste-to-energy plants. It's a very strong drive, because you make lots of money from it, but it's destructive. Waste should be dealt with, I'll come to that later, to its best potential. That means that the biodegradable waste must become compost, must go back into the earth, and the dry waste must be carefully and meticulously go to sorting stations, be sorted, and the value of it re-got, I can't use the word, whatever, retrieved. But I want to just remind us, this is now under that section where I say there's abundant scientific, this is a chapter starting, we wish to point out that section 18.3d enjoins the minister to consider relevant scientific information with respect to extended producer responsibility. Now,
what page are you reading?
I'm reading from a page with big letters so that I can see. The one you've got is a smaller page. This is under section. It's midway into section 2.2 years ago, quite a way down into that. Where I said it's in the bill that he must consider the scientific evidence, and his duty of care also puts that responsibility on him. Now, South Africa is a signatory to the Stockholm Convention, to the FOPS Treaty, and all the burn technologies, whatever these claims these people say, the burn technologies take with them the formation of these very poisonous substances, the oxybenzurans, which are forbidden in the one of the 12 dangerous pops, which are persistent organic pollutants. And in the bill, they said that we must honor our international obligations also. And I feel from that point of view, too, we can't consider extraction of energy from waste, no retrieval of energy from waste, because it destroys good resource material, and it runs the danger of the serious pollution. And as you know, I'm sure the House will have had papers read to it, the dangers of these pollutants, they're cancer forming, they disrupt endocrine systems, and altogether they affect they can make abnormal births, all these kinds of things, and we know that that is scientifically proven, so that we must take great care of that, and the bill must proscribe that we will not have waste to energy in this country. It's not in the interest of the people. And I've written, the next paragraph is rather a fierce paragraph. It says, "Deep cannot plead ignorance of the very real danger to health which all forms of incineration hold. We want the waste to energy plants veto, as well as incineration processes of waste." There are certain industries, I suppose, where the degree of incineration is part of their technology. So one cannot make a blanket say for that, but it's for when there is waste material that should not be incinerated. We have better means and constructive means to do it. We say it would be tantamount to reneging on their duty of care if they were to allow this. Furthermore, DEED is unable to monitor and control these emissions. We therefore urgently request, I must just say this, that we cannot on the continent of Africa test for dioxins. It's an expensive test. It's got to be sent to Germany or I think America, and 160,000 for one little test, something like that, was quoted to me 5 years ago. It might be much more expensive now for all I know. But so we cannot run the risk. And I remember when there was the application for Sasselberg for the hazardous waste incinerator they wanted to do there. And in the that study document they bring out, you know, I can't think of the word now, that first scoping document, the people, the applicants made the claim that they would test for pollution on site. Now that is misleading the public and misleading the councillors who have to make decisions. That is simply a lie. They cannot test for all the pollutants, particularly not these dangerous pollutants on site. There's no such thing. I say these, we urgently request that the bill must forbid energy recovery from waste and the incineration of waste. These are destructive processes which, if full cost accounting is done, are not financially viable. All the burn technologies result in the release of dioxins. I've said that before, so I'm going to skip that a little bit. I say we must therefore demand that the definition of recovery be changed to make it possible to distinguish clearly in what sense the word is being used. Recovery in its positive sense, in which we would want it to be used, might be defined as recovery for the purpose of this bill refers to the controlled recovery of a material as a resource, the retrieval or salvaging of material from waste for reuse. as a result. That is the positive state, but not. And the process of the retrieval of energy from waste needs to be unambiguously defined separately, needs a separate definition by simply defining it under the terms retrieval of energy from waste, and then make this distinction necessary to make it clear. And then, as I say, we would want the process, technology of recovery of energy from waste not to be accepted for this country as a technology. Now, what I've done, the 2.3 is very tedious. I've gone through the whole bill to show wherever this term comes up. And that can't be interpreted as I say. Now, first of all, in the definition of the word waste, it occurs twice. I'm not going to read all these definitions now, but they are those that you're interested in. In the definition of waste management activity, there it is again. In the definition of waste treatment facility, it's there also. Storage, recovery, treatment, reprocessing, recycling. But how do you interpret recovery there? Then, throughout the bill, throughout the rest of the bill, outside of the definitions, we get it under the Section 2, Object of the Act, which says to protect health, well-being, and environment by providing reasonable measures for Section 3, reducing, reusing, recycling, and recovering waste. In Section 7, which is the national norms and standards, it occurs again. And then in Section 8, the provincial norms and standards, there it is. Section 9, also where municipalities may set their standards and so, local standards for the management of solid waste, including requirements in respect of the avoidance and minimization of the generation of waste and the reuse, recycling and recovery of solid waste. We don't know what they are referring to there. Part 3, Chapter 4, under waste management measures, again the heading reads, reduction, reuse, recycling and recovery. Section 51, on the contents of waste management licenses. Once again, the license must specify the amount and type of waste generated, processed, stored, reduced, reused, recycled, recovered or disposed of. And then in the Section B of that we also have it. The license must specify the conditions in respect of the reduction, reuse, recycling and recovery of waste. Now Chapter 6 on waste information, with the establishment of National Information Service by the Minister, this must include data. I say the data must also include the recovered waste. And then under Section 61, objectives of the National Waste System, provide information to organs of state and the public on the status of the generation, collection, reduction, reduce, recycling and recovery, transportation, treatment and disposal of the waste. And then under Section 6, subsection 6, the impact of waste on health and the environment. Now, I've included that because if we allow the extraction of energy from waste, then it has a dreadful impact on the health and the environment. So these two things are in direct conflict. In Section 69, regulations by the Minister, the Minister may make regulations regarding, now, it is the utilization of waste by recovery, and I said here, note recovery listed first, recovery, reuse and recycling. Can we assume that recovery here is in the sense of the salvaging of material. We don't know. We can't say. And then finally, in the section, in the memorandum at the end of the document, under 1.6, there it lists what the bill specifically provides for. The 10th bullet point gives minimization, reduction, reuse, recycling, and recovery of waste. Once again, one must ask, does recovery tariff refer to a waste energy from waste to energy process or to the salvaging of resources? Now, that's not all I've put in about recovery, but it's a big, big issue, you'll understand that. Then I've mentioned a few definitions which I missed in the definition section. First of all, the word incineration is not defined. We don't want to encourage it, but we feel there should be a definition because it is mentioned in the section at the back. I'm so sorry. Thank you. We propose that the definition for incineration as it occurs in the Marine Conservation Bill be adapted for use in this. It is incineration means a deliberate combustion of any material for the purpose of disposing of it by thermal destruction. And I don't know if you've had someone like Mona Lakazi also present to the House on the process of thermal destruction. You know, whatever these claims are, when you have mixed waste, and as it is heated, and as it cools down, these poisonous substances form. At top heat, they are destroyed. So it doesn't happen when it's burning at full force, but every time it has to start up again, you know, they've got to service these things from time to time. As it warms up again, and as it cools down again, you get this formation. I'm not a scientist, I'm not going further into this, but I'm sure if necessary you could get people to talk scientifically to you about that. So we urgently request that the bill explicitly define incineration and reject it as a technology which we can accept. Except in a case I put here for cremation, I wouldn't say that one hasn't got to retain that as a, I don't know, that's for the House to think about, but only incineration of municipal waste is a wickedness. Then secondly, I'd like to see the term separation at source defined. That's with respect to municipal domestic solid waste. We just propose that this should be defined as separate, and I don't know if there's much detail, I can go there or later, but what I propose should happen, and this to me is very close to my heart. If we're facing global warming, we're facing the dangers of pollution, what we should do on a national scale is have separation at source, not in an intricate way they do it in Germany with eight bins in their systems and so forth, but just three bins. We need a bin for the wet waste, the biodegradable waste. Then we need a bin or a bag for the dry waste, the recyclables. And then we need a small little bag for the toxic things like bulbs and batteries and things. And I'm going to deal with it now, it comes up again later, but municipalities must take responsibility for the collection. There's no way, here in Cape Town we're now trying it out in a small way. In some instances they say they've got these recycling points that people have to take their recyclable goods there. But now that means one car with one bag every time somebody goes and drops something off. And many people are just too lazy to do it. This has got to be on a much more ordered scale. Municipal lorries must come collect the dry waste, which goes to a sorting station, where you then employ people on an ongoing basis, labor-intensive basis. And it's done scientifically and carefully, and you get your value from it. The biodegradable waste has to go to composting yards. It can be ordinary composting, or like you had in Mumbai and India, it can be worm composting. The half of Mumbai used worm composting. It's a wonderful technology, and that compost must go back into our soil. We are facing global warming. We need to enrich our soil to have more compost to hold water better. and to help have better crops. So it should be a policy. What I wanted to say about Cape Town, in some areas now they've got this, but a wheelie bin with a wet waste, a bag full of dry waste, you're supposed to put your bag on top of the wheelie bin, then comes a lorry and tips it off into the back. So what's the good of that? I mean, we've got to be sensible and practical and have a conscience about these things. Okay, then I just want to say that I think landfill site should also be defined as such. In the definitions we get waste disposal facility. Now that I think is too encompassing or a little bit perhaps confusing, since it apparently includes landfills and such where, for example, hospital waste can be autoclaved and microwaved. All of these are disposal facilities. We must distinguish these things because these are important separate processes. And then another point that was in our April submission also, we find that there are too many discretionary elements in the bill. The thing that I most have a problem with is that the minister and his delegated representatives are given discretionary powers with respect to licensing and the granting of exemptions. We believe that there is a need for a waste commission. Now, we haven't had a response on that. We think it could advise the minister and lay some guidelines or criteria by which these decisions should be made. And then I said we note with appreciation that for the identification of priority wastes, the minister must engage in a consultative process and public participation, and they link it to sections 72 and 73. Now that sounds very good, but what is a matter of concern to us is that when they, in 72.1, it makes provision for the consultation, it qualifies that by adding consultative process as may be appropriate in the circumstances. Where does that leave us? Who decides on what is appropriate and what do they then allow? This is an element that we cannot accept. It's got to be a better way of doing it. Likewise, in 73.3, it determines the minister or MSC, as the case may be, may, in appropriate circumstances, allow an interested person or community to present and present oral representations or objections. It should not be qualified. Then too, as regards the transfer of a waste management license, 52A reads, if the environment or the rights or interests of other parties are likely to be adversely affected, the minister or MSC must, before deciding the application for transfer, request the applicant to conduct a consultative process that may be appropriate in the circumstances. How is this appropriate circumstance to be decided? Then in point 5 that I made, now I'm not going to repeat this again, was expanding more on the question of the separation of municipal waste. I've dealt with that, the dry waste and the wet waste and the toxic waste. And then point 5.2 makes the point that we believe if we deal with our waste in this way, we should not be licensing new landfills for municipal waste. Municipal waste should not be, the wet and the dry waste should not be going to landfills. Only the toxics must a landfill deal with, because there are ways that you detoxify it before you take it there. Certain things have to be encapsulated in concrete, so there is a safe storage for that. But as I said, the better methods of composting and recycling have to be full-scale concerns. Then I have a few more concerns. I'm nearly at the end. 6.1, additional changes needed. Now we say the consultative process with respect to regulations. The bill designates virtually every aspect of waste management to future regulation. Now, to me, it's not good enough to say this is a framework. We'll do it all by regulation later. A study of Section 69, regulations by the Minister, reveals an unshorted bunch of topics, some of which belong in the bill as principles, such as duty of care. And 69.8 talks about life cycle assessment. These things belong with the principles. They don't belong there, you know. We ask that it be rewritten into the Act that before regulations are published, the Minister must engage in a proper consultative process with the public, as set out there in 72.3. We have not really had that in a proper way. The other issue that I must just mention is the issue of appeals. This bill has one little section on appeals, section 78, but that deals only with where there is the instance of joint issues which more than one ministry has to deal with. You know, it could be the water affairs or whatever. I said the appeals deal mostly with joint consideration of an appeal and the minister or MEC's power to indicate the process that must be followed. And then I don't want to take the time of the House to do all of this, but I'd like to read 62.3. We reject the fact that provision for the appeal procedures should be relegated to regulation. An appeal process is part of your basic frame. This is allowed, and this is what happens when it doesn't happen. It should be in the Act, properly dealt with. Now, either it should unequivocally state that the appeal procedure in NEMA should be followed, as set out in NEMA, or otherwise it must have its own statement there for appeals. And then section 6.2.5, I say in section 49, which deals with decisions of licensing authorities on waste management license applications. Section 49.4 determines that after the licensing authority has reached a decision, it must notify the applicant. Section 49.4c determines that this must be done in a manner determined by the licensing authority, instruct the applicant to notify any persons who have objected to the application of the decision and the reasons for the decision. You will note that it doesn't do what is standard procedure to say you have to object it, that you have 20 days or 30 days in which to appeal against this decision. I cannot understand how that can be missing from this. I'd be grateful if the House would read that again. They must notify you your objection failed and give you the reasons and down there you're your best. Now, my penny appealing. You know, it's just not good enough. The standard civilized procedure is that if you have a case, you should be able to appeal that decision. In the memorandum, this is now 6.2.6, the memorandum of objects of the National Management Waste Bill, page 45, under 1.6, it lists what the bill specifically provides for. Please note that no mention here is made of the right to appeal. So if you would look at that section at the back again, please, also. Then, variation of waste management licenses. I just wish to make a point that no provision is made for a third party or parties to request that the license be varied. Now, you might be the neighbor to a certain activity that's been licensed and then realize that something is going amiss. Now, the minister may request that it be varied, and the owner of the license may request that it be reviewed. But I contend that an ordinary person should be able to approach the officer, the licensing officer, and say, we think that license should be reviewed. Something for you to consider, please. And then, my spell check. brought in the word categorization with an American spelling, but it should be classification and categorization of wastes. We just feel that has to be tightened up. Electronic waste and nuclear waste are not mentioned, and then medical waste also need to be distinguished. I'm not really embroidered on that, but for a waste management bill, those things have to be addressed. Finally, standards, well, second last point, standards. Now, the minister at national level regulates the standards. Our concern is that in many instances, such as in the case of dioxin being formed and heavy metals being present in bottom ash, not even the Air Quality Act makes provision for the setting of standards regarding the levels of toxic substances that may be released into the environment. Now, we just like that to be put to the Bureau of Standards or whoever deals with it, and for us to consider. You know, there are only about 6 air quality things that they were going to set standards for, and that is not adequate. Because these very dangerous poisons are ignored. And this is my final point on the importation of waste. In section 74K and L of the bill, the previous one, the one that was published in January, it dealt with the prohibition or restriction of the import and sale of any product or classes of products in such circumstances as may be prescribed, and with procedures for the importation and exportation of waste. Now, that bill put that on the table. The current bill doesn't mention this importation and exportation. It's a very real problem in the world today. Many countries want to get rid of their harmful waste. We had recently the case of Brazil that tried to stop the European Union from exporting their used tires to Brazil. You must have heard of that. And then Brazil didn't want it, they refused it. And then the European Union, as it were, took them to court, the World Trade Court or whatever it is they have, to try to force them to do it. Now, Brazil won in this first round, but we believe that the European Union is now again appealing against that. Now, it is impossible that a country should be, in this case, forced to accept substances, because they said tires get one more life, and then they are waste tires, and then they're ready for burning. And I mean, something which I haven't put in my paper, but which is very close to my heart, is this issue of tires. We have now this unbelievable licensing by DEET of allowing trial burns of all kinds of other materials, including tires and including municipal waste. Now, I just want to put it to the House, you cannot bag a cement kiln to catch the dangerous substances that come from it. You can bag a Saldana steel outlet. It's a small thing. It costs them millions. For 10 years I was their secretary, I know what they spent on that. But it's not possible to bag and to make safe emissions from a cement kiln. So it links up with this whole issue of importation of hazardous waste or any kind of harmful waste, but if it comes to us and people think now they can burn it in the cement kilns, that means a profit for the cement factories because it's cheap, cheaper to burn tires than to do things the proper way. We really would like the bill to deal with this and take into account the Basel Convention and the Polokwane Declaration on these issues. And finally, in conclusion, I appeal to the Portfolio Committee to help our country to achieve waste management legislation that will not be open to exploitation and not lead to health risks or degradation of the environment that can, with good legislation, be avoided. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Madam Rule. As I said,
so long.
You never disappoint. Comprehensive, gentle, very high quality of work. Thank you very much. At this stage, I'm going to
We submitted extensive comments on the original bill, and as you know from last week, it was consideration of the Business Association. We at the time welcomed the introduction of the bill because, as you yourself said, this is a very important piece of legislation. It's the first time that we attempted to put all waste management legislation together, and we really welcome that. We think it's a very worthwhile piece of legislation. We engaged with the department through the public process that they initiated, and we must say that at that time we had a huge number of concerns on the board.
The problem, Dr. Locke, is that you diminish our own public participation on your
presentation.
So we can engage with it properly. Okay. The more amendable document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, and thank you to the honourable members of the committee for this opportunity. If I can introduce myself, I'm Paul Kennedy. I'm an advocate. I'm a senior counsel of the Johannesburg Bar. I'm briefed on my right by Mr. Greg Edelstein, the attorney for the Metal Recyclers Association. And on my left, if I can introduce, on my far left, Mr. Bernard Maguire. He's the chair of the Metal Recyclers Association. He's also director of CroniMet. And to my immediate left is Mr. David Lowenthal, who's also an executive member of the Metal Recyclers Association and is from Universal Recycling. Mr. Chairperson, we've submitted written submissions last week, and I'd like to highlight just a few aspects of those submissions today orally. If we can start out by making it clear that the Metal Recyclers Association is, of course, dealing specifically with the function of recycling. And we accept, Mr. Chairperson, that the bill seeks to optimize recycling. It seeks to avoid a situation where items, whether they be metal items or anything else, should lie around in the felt or in the towns, polluting the environment, or may land up in landfill sites and therefore reduce the suitable environment for proper purposes. And recycling of metal products has been an industry in this country for over a century. By their very nature, metals clearly have a substantial value, far in excess of the negligible value that such items as plastics may have. So they're a special category of items that are capable of being recycled and are to a very large extent already recycled by sheer outcome of the fact that they do have a value. And there is no legislation that is needed, we would submit to the committee, to compel or encourage further recycling of metals, because this happens in any event. Now, we've set out in our written submission a summary of the role that the metal recycling industry plays in the economy and in relation to the environment. And we've set out in particular at page 4 of our written submissions a quotation from a paper that was prepared by the University of the Witwatersrand as a study for purposes of the DTI, the Department of Trade and Industry. And if I can just read to you the important section, what the authors of the study say is, most importantly, metals provide a unique environmental advantage due to their value, consistent performance characteristics, durability, chemical properties, and wide range of uses. Most metals can be repeatedly recycled. Technological improvements in metal recovering processes over the years have enabled the industrial smelters and foundries to increase metal yields obtained from secondary metals. Now, this is one of the important environmental benefits. Less electricity is used in the process, and little chemical or structural change occurs, it should read, occurs, not incurs, in the resultant product, engendering significant economic cost advantages. For example, aluminium scrap can be recycled repeatedly using only 5% of the energy to provide aluminium ingots compared to virgin aluminium, and generates only 5% of the greenhouse gas emissions. Recycled iron and steel and copper result in energy savings of 74% and 85% respectively. Steel scrap also forms an integral part in the production of stainless steel. Lead that is recycled requires about 35 to 40% of the energy needed to produce lead from the ore. Furthermore, recycling conserves natural resources, extends the life of materials, reduces stress on municipal landfills, very important aspect, and incinerators, and results in substantial energy savings and significant reductions in effluent, particulate, and greenhouse gas emissions. So we make the point, as has the University of Witwatersrand in the study, that metal... Metal recycling already plays a very important part of recycling and therefore being of benefit to the environment. We refer at page 8 of our submissions to the very substantial volumes of scrap metals that are involved, that are generated and recycled in this country and recycled by members of our clients, the Metal Recyclers Association, and the numerous others at the smaller end of the recycling chain. For example, ferrous metal scrap generated locally amounts to almost to approximately 2.5 million tons per year. The market has seen very rapid growth in volumes over the past few years, and with the growing economy both here and in countries such as China, one can expect very substantial increases in those volumes. Volumes of non-ferrous scrap metals are also substantial, although considerably lower than that of ferrous scrap metals, but the monetary value is even higher than ferrous scrap and is therefore even more attractive to recyclers. So we're talking, Mr. Chairperson, of very substantial volumes of metal, scrap metal. Now, that is dealt with to a very substantial degree in the recycling industry. It has enormous benefits for the local economy. But most important for your purposes, honourable members of this committee, it plays a very vital role in dealing with the recycling of products that, but for that recycling, would cause a serious pollution problem. It would cause a serious increase in the need for landfill and the like. So we make the point that this recycling advances environmental management objectives, such as those very commendable objectives that are set out in the bill before you. Now it in particular, it minimizes the consumption of natural resources. One doesn't have to mine iron ore, for example, in anything like the quantities that would be required but for recycling. It minimizes the generation of waste. It minimizes the requirements for energy that are far more substantial if one is processing virgin ore and virgin metal products, and it prevents pollution and ecological degradation. And Mr. Chairperson, in paragraph 15 of our written submissions, we set out a summary of the scrap metals industry in which we seek to illustrate the very diverse range of operators within the industry. My client, the Metal Retailers Association, represents directly the larger operators in the industry. The smaller operators in the industry play, however, a very vital role, and they all interact with each other. So, for example, the large scrap processors and the large scrap merchants, which are members of the retail of the Metal Recyclers Association, act together with the smaller operators in the first two categories that we've set out in our paragraph, the so-called peddlers and the bucket shops. If I can just give an example, just an illustration of the peddlers. One sees these particularly in large cities such as that where we come from, Johannesburg, where one has single person operations, often just moving around industrial areas or commercial areas, often just pushing a supermarket trolley or some other form of trolley, picking up metal, scrap metal that's lying around in the shelf or in the alleyways, or may pick up items from, for example, factories where they have disused metal products or surplus metal requirements or old vehicle engines or the like, and they leave them out in the backyard because they know that these peddlers will come by with their trolleys and pick them up. So too, there are small operators in the form of bucket shops, frequently two or three or four person operations, sometimes with a vehicle, sometimes not. And as we indicate, there are approximately 3,000 bucket shops in South Africa. There are far more peddlers, many, many thousands of peddlers. Then we have the scrap merchants, approximately 1,000 registered scrap metal merchants. And they use various types of vehicles. And then we have the large-scale operators, the scrap processors, the large businesses. But of course, even those large operators, they are able to rely on the bucket shops and the peddlers for sourcing a large volume of the scrap metals that they have to deal with. Well, so much for the nature and the importance of the metal recycling industry, both for the economy and for the environment. Why does our client, the association, and its members have a particular concern in relation to the bill? Well, firstly, may we start by indicating that the association and its members is strongly in support of the bill and of its objectives, many of which are served by our clients themselves. But it has a concern too, and the concern is that the definition of waste seems to us and to our clients to go too far. And we've put out in our written submission an argument which we want to elaborate on today, which effectively says this. The definition of waste should be aimed at what is truly waste. The definition should be aimed at promoting the recycling of waste, the minimizing of landfill, the minimizing of provision for waste which cannot be recycled. It should not, however, include scrap metals which by their very nature can be recycled, are being recycled in an industry which is well organized and which is highly effective in achieving the very objectives of the Act. It is not needed to cast the net of this bill to include scrap metals, which, because from the moment that they are collected, they have a value. They're not discarded items that are without value or that have absolutely negligible value. For example, a factory or a shop that is throwing out bits of plastic and cardboard and the like, which have no value to the shop and do not have the sort of value that makes it truly worthwhile for collectors such as the peddlers operating in this industry. If we can take you, Mr. Chairperson and members of the committee, to the definition of waste in section 1 of the bill, we've quoted it for your convenience on pages 12 and 13 of our written submission. The definition starts: any substance, whether or not that substance can be reduced, reused, recycled and recovered, A, that is surplus, unwanted, rejected, discarded, abandoned or disposed of, B, where the generator has no further use of for the purposes of production, reprocessing or consumption, C, that must be treated or disposed of, or D, that is identified as waste by the minister. But, and there are sensibly certain exclusions, but Roman 1, a byproduct is not considered waste, and Roman 2, any portion of waste once reused, recycled and recovered ceases to be waste. Mr. Chairperson, as we and our clients understand this wording of the definition, and particularly the exclusions that follow from the word but, the Roman 1 and 2, what the objective of the drafters of this bill is really to say, well, one has waste, but a point is reached at which waste achieves a value and no longer falls within what one can, in terms of ordinary conventional understanding of waste, means what is truly waste. So if there's a byproduct of a product, that is not to be considered waste. That's paragraph Roman 1. And paragraph Roman 2, any portion of waste once reused, recycled and recovered ceases to be waste. Now, those exclusions in the definition make with respect perfect sense. Because once there is a byproduct, it has value and that shouldn't be regarded as waste. Once an item is reused, recycled and recovered, it ceases to be waste. What we are submitting on behalf of our clients is something very limited. It's to extend the exclusions so that scrap metals, once they are collected for purposes of recycling, they too will be excluded from the definition of waste. If one does not change the wording of the definition as we've suggested, the effect is that where, for example, the peddler or the bucket shop picks up an item, or a larger scrap merchant or a scrap processor comes to collect a large volume of scrap metal from the generator of that waste, at that stage it remains waste. Only at the point when it falls within paragraph Roman 2 that it is reused, recycled, and recovered does it cease to be waste.
Okay, can you take this point? I think it's a fundamental point. That's the product again.
What we suggest, Mr. Chairperson, is this, that where scrap metal items have been collected for purposes of recycling, for example, when a peddler goes to the back alley behind a factory or a shop and picks up disused or abandoned scrap metal and collects it for purposes of recycling, he or she will take it on to a bucket shop, for example, or to a scrap merchant directly. The scrap merchant then supplies volumes of scrap metal to the processor. All of these elements in the chain of recovery and aimed at recycling. At the time of collection of the items, according to this definition, it is still waste. Those items will only cease to be waste in terms of the current definition, Roman 2, once they have become reused, recycled, and recovered. And what we're suggesting on behalf of the association and its members is that waste should cease to be waste in relation to scrap metals because of their high value, because they are destined for recycling, that they should cease to be waste at the stage that they are collected. Because if they're not, then every stage of this collection process aimed at recycling will be subjected to the provisions of the Act, where this is unnecessary, we submit, and secondly, is going to lead ironically to something that is clearly counterproductive. And that is what we develop in a later section of the submission. Let us explain to the committee why it is inappropriate for that stage from the moment of collection for such scrap metals also to constitute waste. Of particular concern is the financial burden that will result to the association's members, and not only the large-scale operators who are members of the association, but for the many thousands of peddlers and bucket shop operators who operate throughout the country and play a vital role, not only in supplying our clients' members with the scrap metal that they need for their operations, but also to ensure viable businesses of these many thousands of peddlers and bucket shop operators and the important role that they play in recycling and in ensuring a safe and healthy environment. We've set out in our submission, by way of example, the sort of effect that would result, for example, in Johannesburg. Paragraph 32 on page 18. We refer to the additional financial burdens that will be sustained by, for example, operators within the industry which use vehicles. Obviously, by their very nature, once they are volumes that cannot be transported in the supermarket trolley that a peddler may use, then one has to start using vehicles. And in Johannesburg, for example, in terms of the bylaws that deal with waste, if scrap metals are now to constitute waste in terms of the bill, the knock-on effect of this will be considerable financial costs, which will inevitably affect the viability of the entire industry, not only the large operators who are members of the Recyclers Association, but the many small operators who play an important part in the industry. We've given examples of the costs in relation to vehicles. There'll be a registration cost for the operation, a registration cost per vehicle of the order of 12,000 rand per vehicle. For example, if an operator in the illustration that we've given has 15 vehicles, this will amount to approximately 200,000 Danish per annum. Then there'll be additional costs involving environmental impact studies, employment of additional staff members, etc. Now all of that we submit to this committee is unnecessary, because the industry is regulating, is in fact the whole purpose of the industry itself is recycling. Now where will those costs be absorbed? We've been at pains in our written submission to point out that this is a cost-sensitive industry, highly cost-sensitive industry, where the margins, the gross and profit, profit margins, are extremely narrow, and particularly so for the smaller operators, the peddlers and the bucket shops and the smaller scrap merchants. Extremely narrow indeed. Now, if these costs are to be incurred unnecessarily, we submit, in the industry, inevitably they're going to... Inevitably they're going to be passed on down the line. One cannot pass on such costs, for example, to the purchasers at the end of the recovery and recycling process. Much of the scrap metals is exported. Purchaser in China or India is not going to be interested in additional environmental costs that are incurred as a result of legislation in South Africa. So where will the costs be absorbed? Costs will be absorbed in this way. But where, for example, a scrap metal processor or a scrap merchant is having to incur very substantial additional costs as a result of this legislation applying to them, it will have to recover that by way of providing less of a price to the people who supply them with metal, and in particular the peddlers and scrap merchants, the bucket shops that supply to the scrap merchants. Now, we've pointed out in our submissions that particularly the peddlers and the scrap metal bucket shops operate at such small margins that they will be extremely hard hit by a reduction in the price that they receive. We gave an example in the townships. The experience of many members of the association which we represent is that these scrap metal peddlers will go around in the townships and in the commercial areas picking up odds and ends, and then come to the scrap merchants and then sell the small items that they've been able to collect. But in wintertime, when there's another need in the townships for people to be peddling, for fuel in the townships, they will instead divert their efforts and energy, in many cases, to peddling items such as coal and wood to provide fuel to people in the townships. And the figures from our, from the members of the association reflect that they receive less volume in winter months in scrap metal products, because these peddlers are able now to be earning a bit more by peddling something else. Instead of picking up scrap metal and taking it to the scrap merchants and processors, instead they're picking up coal and wood, or selling coal and wood in the township door to door. That illustrates how narrow a profit is generated by scrap metal sales for people like the peddlers and the bucket shop operators. Now it takes little imagination to realize that if their margin on scrap metal is reduced even more, then it may well result in many of their operations becoming unviable. So, the point we make is this, that if the objective of the bill is to promote recycling, ironically, that objective will not be achieved if the scrap metal process of collection is included in the net, is included in the definition of waste, and not excluded as we submit it should be. Effectively, by applying it to the scrap metal industry, this legislation will provide a disincentive to recycle. The peddlers and the bucket shops will not collect the same volume. We're not suggesting that peddlers and bucket shops, all of them will be eliminated overnight. But inevitably the volumes of scrap metal that will be collected will be smaller. Inevitably, the numbers of peddlers and bucket shops will reduce because there will be less incentive for them to be in the industry. So there will be a disincentive if this legislation were to apply to the industry. And what then would become of the scrap metal that is lying around that these peddlers and bucket shops are collecting so vigorously and so efficiently at the moment? They'll be left discarded. They'll be left to pollute the environment, rusting in the felts, rusting in the alleyways, rusting in the residential areas. They will not be sent on for recycling. There'll be a reduction in recycling. Again, recycling is an objective of the legislation. There will be a greater need to use virgin metal, metal that has not been recycled, but rather is first generation metal, as it were, that has been produced from mining processes, using far greater energy, producing far greater pollution as well. And if it is collected, who will have to do the collection? It will be the authorities that will have to do the collection. And it will simply burden further the landfill sites, which are already a problem in this country, in the urban areas in particular. And again, we need to remind the committee that, of course, one of the objectives of the bill is to reduce rather than increase landfill site provision. If we can refer you also, Mr. Chairperson, to the bill, one example of the problems that will arise if scrap metals are not excluded from the definition of waste is to be found in section 24, which prohibits persons from collecting waste for removal from premises unless such person is A, a municipality or municipal service provider, B, authorized by law to collect that waste where authorization is required, or C, not prohibited from collecting that waste. Now this, as we read it, would mean that, for example, peddlers would have to become authorized before they could collect out and about as they do scrap metals that are lying around or that are left out by factories, shops and the like. That we submit is inappropriate. What we submit is appropriate is to confine the legislation to what is truly waste. Waste is something that is valueless. Waste, to all intents and purposes. If it has a negligible value, it is also properly to be regarded as waste. But where it has a high value, such as scrap metals have a high value, where they are by their very nature being collected, being recycled, then they should be excluded from the legislation. And we've proposed what we submit is a very simple change to the definition. You'll find it at the end of our written submission. We took you earlier to the definition of waste in section 1 of the bill, which has the two categories of exclusion after the word but. You'll recall I referred to the Roman 1 and Roman 2 in the definition after the words but. And we suggest a change simply by inserting an additional paragraph, Roman 3, with the wording that we've suggested at the tail end of our written presentation. That is, any scrap metals which have a value and are disposed of or collected for purposes of processing, reuse, recycling or recovery shall not constitute waste. It simply means that where they have value at the point of their being collected, they are now in the chain of recycling which does not require the bill to apply to it. The objective of the bill is already achieved by the very fact that they are collected for purposes of processing, reuse, recycling and recovery. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Those are our submissions.
Thank you very much, Advocate Kennedy, again for a useful intervention. I invite members to respond to both Madame Wu and Madame Kuhn.
direct my response to Advocate Kennedy. I really appreciate the scholarly and insightful contribution that he's made to enable us and peace to come up with a good law. Now, the challenge that we have in narrowing the definition of waste, I'd like to juxtapose with the doctrine of presumption of innocence. It might sound a bit facetious, right? In the doctrine of innocence, they say a person presumes to be innocent until proven guilty. Now, if you use waste, you see, waste is waste until process and reuse, etc., etc. Would that appear too facetious? I do have another suggestion there, that couldn't we use a penalty, because I'm sympathetic to these vendors who collect the waste, they shouldn't be discouraged, but we have not seen the environment. But in order not to give them a blanket of amnesty that, okay, because of the good intention to pick up the scrap metal, the moment you pick up that rusted piece of steel, you see foam paper in crossroads, the moment you pick it up, magically, it ceases to be waste. Then also say, when it gets into a sophisticated high-tech environment of reprocessing, then it also ceases to be waste. You see, it will appear a bit crude, because the understanding is that when people pick it up from the street, it's still waste until it goes in a high-tech environment which you, in a good association, process it, then it ceases to be waste. At that point, to me, that is now a decisive point where it ceases. So there cannot be two points of ceasing, that when the Mulani picks it up from the street, it is not waste, it ceases waste. And then it goes into some rickety vehicle, jalopy, and goes to the factory, then it also ceases to waste. You see, to me that should be, it appears very, I'm looking for the word now, it appears to be, will be too generous. But I sympathize with you. My suggestion would be, right, to protect the fellow picked up from the street. Because you must raise all these 12 people, 10 other people, they have a permit. So as to, not to make them liable to punitive measure. But the cessation of waste should be when it enters an environment of technology, because it's common sense there, because then, you know, it could be reused, etc., etc. So I thought I could just make that contribution and see how far it goes. Obviously, you're a lawyer, you might also be featured in my crude juxtaposition of presumption of innocence. Yeah, but I just thought it might be interesting to hear a comment on that.
If you could note the question we'll take around. Mashama?
Yeah, I can see there's a lot of merit in this submission, because immediately a piece of metal is picked up, its number one step in the whole process of recycling. I spent a day in at the Canberra Waste, big waste management storage facility, and as far as they're concerned, there is actually no such thing as waste. Everything has value and is of some use to somebody. I just wonder, with your submission and your application to have scrap metal excluded from the whole definition of waste, would there not be many other now at present collectors of waste that would feel that their whatever they were collecting also could fall in? Okay. Would they not also feel that they qualified, because from the moment of pickup, they would be on their way to becoming recycled, and there's not nearly enough of it that happens in this country. And I think metal does fall into a particular category, especially copper parts, etc. And but surely even the peddlers and the bucket shops should be have some sort of jurisdiction and regulation that governs whatever they do. I mean, are you saying that it should be one aspect of what is at present waste that should be unregulated and not really and just do its own thing and go its own way? I can see that it is I drive down Portrico Road every morning on my way to Parliament, and there are a couple of pickup shops there for the upper bale bucket shops. And I mean, they're open early, and it's a lucrative little business. It really is. It provides a living for a lot of people. And I mean, your implication is that this would put a financial burden on them that might even conceivably push them out of the market. But I would like to know what your concept of is, how it should be regulated in that case.
Thank you, Mashama Manduli.
But thanks, Chipperson. Chipperson, I'm having the slight problem, like my colleagues have said, on excluding the scrap metal. You see, if you go to Guamashu, you will find maybe in a row two or three houses with old cars that have been there for two to 4 years. And when it's raining, a lot of water will be kept there, and eventually you are creating your own home for mosquitoes. And at the same time, you put danger to your children, because once it's there, probably they'll be playing in it. And now I had to battle with my man to say, what do we then call that old car that was on the yard there for 2 to 3 years? Is it not waste? Because again, I think my belief is up until is used for recycling, it's no longer the waste. And again, I wanted to check to say with the metal recycling, what policies do they have? Because at some stage, just new metals, like copper, for instance, in townships, you'll find the taps loose, and you'll be told that a copper has been taken out there. What policy do you have on recycling? Because Do you recycle the old scrap metals, or even if it's a new thing? Because at the same time, we need to protect our society. Because at some stage, a car is just hijacked to be stripped. just to be straight and serve the parts. And those parts are not the old scripts, etc. Thank you, Chair. But one other thing, Chair, because you said two of them. But one other thing, Chair, from the lady was this. I was a bit puzzled because the NEMA principle is already there. So if we are saying it is guiding us, I think it's appropriate. But if we are saying now we shouldn't use that guide, but should say must be guided. I was a little bit puzzled there. Maybe if I can get the clarity thing.
You, Mandur Vaskalana, followed by Honorable Kogos.
Chairperson, I would like to thank the advocate for the definition of waste. I was a bit worried. What do we need waste? Some people cannot just make the difference between this and that. Fine. But it's just a simple question because, you know, we live with those people, the vendors, who go around asking, could you kindly give me a piece of scrap wood, iron, whatever. They go around. So there are these bucket shops. I know it might not be easy for your advocate to know how do they go about when the deal between them, the vendors and the bucket shop man. Supposing, let's say, my colleague has just touched on that. The metal is brand new. Maybe there was an accident, then they all it was saved, as she was saying. But now, when that metal is sold, does the value of the old and a new scrap metal matter when it comes to the that bucket shop? Does he get better money or than the one that is selling, the one that has rusted, you know? I'm just worried whether are they not robbed when they sell these scrap metals? Because I remember my car, we had an accident by the Guinea Fire found, you know. The car is still new, but now most of the parts were off just because of that accident. And one vendor came across asking if he would be giving. Then I said, oh, ooh, such big, you know, parts, that to give for free. No. Though I knew they were useless at the time, but I was just a kid, you know. But my question is, he is a man bringing a big piece of metal, shining, to come and sell to the bucket shop. Does he get better price than the one that is bringing something he has picked from that river, the banks of that river, whatever? You know, why I'm asking this question, advocate, so that I can be free to give, you know. I'm worried, how do these market shops, you know, handle the same? Thank you.
Thank you, Makarala.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity.
I came in the middle of the presentation. Nonetheless, the two issues that struck me, one of them is the whole issue against, in terms of our attitude towards the environment. The presenter made mention that China does not care about our environment. Is that then by implication then that we also should not care about our environment if China doesn't care? I think our approach towards the clean and the healthy environment is an issue that I think needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, the people who don't care, who care less about the environment in the recycling scrap industry, are the big guys. SA Metal, as an example of that. You drive around Ford Tracker, there's always belching smoke around SA Metal there. All the people come then burning their scrap. There's been a constant complaint for the past 13 years about SA Metal, all the belching smoke around that area there. The motor industry is complaining, all the industries are complaining, and nothing has ever been done. And these are people seemingly who are not concerned about the environment. I think that bill seeks to address it. Secondly, the question about big trucks. Again, it is big companies. You mentioned Johannesburg. Let me give an example of one of the big scrap metals in your dealer, Score Metal. They're part of Anglo-American. They are the biggest ones. They're the ones who drive all these unroadworthy trucks around Johannesburg. And again, the big trucks has always been an indication that they don't stick to the letter of the law. They overload their trucks. They're supposed to be putting the netting to protect the stocks, and very many of them drive without that netting in terms of protecting the people and the people on the road. I think that's another concern that one would seek clarity on. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Well,
thank you
both of us. Just some questions as well. Madam Rogi, for not asking you questions, it's not because we found your presentation uninteresting. It is because the point you raised, we want us to digest them more. As a friend of the committee, always a very strong. This group from Joburg had to come to Cape Town, so we must interrogate them. The one question I'd like to ask is, first, should one assume that your principal concern is the cost of registration, and that if that cost is not there, you wouldn't mind being registered? Or if the cost is lower, you wouldn't mind being registered? That's the first one. Secondly, you mentioned that the industry is quite huge, $12 billion. I would like to know how is this industry in terms of its global reach? I mean, China was mentioned. It seems as though the Chinese have got an appetite for everything metal these days. So, what's the demand like? I mean, it would be useful to get a sense of what's the demand of scrap metal in the global market. So that will help us ascertain how we should be dealing with industry from the point of view of legislators. You also argue that in the definition of waste, once something has been collected, it should no longer be considered waste. But what happens if it's collected but it's not bought? Are you saying that to me that everything collected automatically is bought? So this is a clear sequence in this market that immediately it's in a trolley. No debate, everything in this industry is going to be bought. Is that what you're telling us? You wanted to respond to the maybe we should allow you to respond now so that the points you want to raise can be responded to as well.
Thank you, Chair. Now, in fact, I also wanted to just ask a question of two questions of clarity. The one is that the licensing in the bill is subject to the list of activities. Now, in that list of activities, there are cut-off schedules. It says above a certain schedule, you must license. And my understanding is from the work that we did that we have excluded most small recyclers. The guys with the with their trolleys and even small vehicles or whatever, my understanding is do not collect above that schedule or do not store above the schedules in the list. So I would appreciate a comment on whether there is a problem with the schedules in the list, because people who are underneath those schedules are either excluded or would need to be regulated in other ways. That was the one. The second thing is that when we're talking about scrap metal, I'd like to understand how we define it. Because to my understanding, a lot of e-waste, for example, computers and cell phones and batteries and shops from medical waste and containers which contain chemicals or hazardous waste, are also metal that in certain cases is recycled. Now, are we going to say in this proposal, do we then exclude all of that as well? So I wanted to understand what then is the cutoff in this proposal, as well as what is the response to what our cutoffs are in the list that is in the legislation. Thanks.
As we go to the advocate to respond, maybe did you know what want to answer upon this one question? In your consultation, did you meet with the peddler? Answer back later.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. If I can take the questions briefly in turn, I think the first question is from the Honourable Mr. McQuena, and he put the example of somebody in a township picking up an item and magically at that particular moment it ceases to be waste. Of course, the current definition in the bill has a magical moment when it ceases to be waste currently, and that is once it is recycled, recovered, or reused. There's nothing in law that should exclude a magical moment, as it were. By very nature, some point has to be set in terms of legislation with some consequences to follow. All that we are suggesting is that the moment when an item which has value, in the case of scrap metal, when it has value, and it is disposed of or collected for purposes of processing, reuse, recycling or recovery shall not constitute waste. So once it falls into that category, from the time that it is disposed of with that purpose or is collected for that purpose, at that stage it ceases to be waste. Of course, the example of Sipo in the township picking up an item, if he is picking it up at all for purposes of recycling, then, but only then, does it cease to become waste. If it's lying in the shelf until that person has picked it up with that purpose, until then it remains waste and is therefore subject to the provisions of the legislation which this bill aims to create. In relation to the second question from the lady opposite, of course it is true with respect that everything has value to somebody, but scrap metals have an unusual feature in that they have a substantial value, and that they can be recycled over and over in perpetuity. The type of waste, other examples of types of waste such as plastic, have minimal negligible value, and they require the sort of policing, monitoring and encouragement of recycling that this bill aims to create. Because metals themselves have such a high value and are easily capable of being reused and recovered and recycled, then it is appropriate that the industry carries on as it is. There is no need to encourage the recycling which is happening in any event. It was also suggested that peddlers need to be regulated, and in relation to a few of your colleagues' questions later, it seems to be suggested that because scrap metals are sometimes associated with other forms of irregularity, that this may require regulation by way of this bill. Of course, we have other good legislation that this Parliament has enacted or is in the process of enacting, such as the Second-Hand Goods Act. The issue of for example, stolen cars and stolen copper, those are, of course, terrible ills in our society, but they are effectively a safety and security issue rather than an environmental issue. They do not require policing by way of environmental legislation. Even if the environmental legislation does apply to those industries, it's not going to make any material impact on that issue. And in any event, environmental legislation must be enacted and used for environmental purposes and not for other purposes. I was asked also as to the question of for example, car wrecked cars lying in somebody's backyard and what sort of value this may have in relation to the disposal of such items, whether it be a high value or a low value, depending on the age. As I understand it, the value paid by scrap merchants and processors for scrap metals such as a car wreck, whether it be a very old car wreck or an accident that has just happened, does not make any material impact on the value. There is a grade and there is a mass that are the factors that that are used in determining the value of scrap metal, and the age does not play any significant role in that regard. In relation to the question from the honourable member on the left, of course it is. I certainly wasn't suggesting when indicating that countries such as China may not have a particular concern about the environment in South Africa, that therefore we in South Africa should not care about our environment, or that my client and its members should have no concern for the environment. Although, of course, one must be quite honest about it, our clients are in the business to make profits. One doesn't have to hide behind that reality. The reality is also that the metal recycling industry is a good example of industry involved in an activity which is aimed specifically at recycling, which has clear benefits for the environment. The suggestion that there are some operators that, for example, belt smoke from their plants or have trucks that are overloaded and don't have their goods covered with nets, undoubtedly in any industry, one will have the bad eggs, as it were, the problem areas. But those are other environmental issues, or traffic regulation issues in the case of overloading trucks and not having nets over items. And those problems should be dealt with not by environmental legislation, but by traffic control legislation. The belching of smoke from processing plants is a matter that is already dealt with in existing environmental legislation. And we're not here to argue against that legislation, which is already on the statute books and is being applied. All that we are arguing against is the extension of the waste bill to an area which we submit does not truly involve waste at all. Scrap metal shouldn't be regarded as waste precisely because it has a substantial value once it is collected. And it is aimed specifically, the very reason why it is collected is so that it can be reprocessed and recycled and therefore benefit the environment. Mr. Chairperson, you raised a couple of questions of us too, which I'd like to address. It is not exclusively cost which is of concern to our clients, although that plays a very important part of it. And that has an effect throughout the industry, as I tried to demonstrate earlier, but I'll deal with that also in relation to a later question. But there are other concerns that the application of the bill, if it's enacted in its present form, will mean that our clients' members will be subjected to regulation which will
simply adds to the burden of operators for regulation where we submit this is unnecessary and inappropriate. You asked about the global reach of the industry and the demand worldwide. The demand worldwide, I'm told, is approximately 140 million tons of scrap metal a year. That is ferrous scrap metal. In addition, there are further millions of tons for non-ferrous, but I assume that it's on the same sort of scale as in South Africa, that non-ferrous represents a much smaller part of the overall tonnages. Ferrous metal, obviously, is the more generally used metal with much, much greater tonnages. And a considerable portion of the 2.5 million tons of ferrous metal that is generated and recycled in the South African industry, a considerable proportion of that is exported. Yes, thank you. Sorry for the interruption. I'm told that South Africa imports approximately 150,000 tons of scrap a year of ferrous, particularly from the neighboring territories, Botswana and Mozambique, etc. And we export recycled metal, the scrap industry, of the order of 250,000 tons per annum. And the world steel production is approximately 1,000 million tons of steel per annum. I'm told also that there's a worldwide problem with the disparity of what comes in and what comes out in particular countries, because this relates to problematic cost conditions and distortions.
What do you say about the market? Look, those who have may not able to accept them from you, but what do they mean? Is the market doing well?
I'm told that South Africa produces in prime steel, it's not just scrap, 11 million tons a year, and worldwide it's approximately 1 billion tons a year. So that's approximately 9% of total world output. May I respond now to the last of the questions which came from the Deputy Director General behind us?
I think your question has not been answered because crime steel does not fall within the ambit of scrap metal. The 11 tons is called a crime steel that gets from the mine, from the iron ore straight. It doesn't go through the scrap metal process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I'm told that the figures for the world I'm told that the world figures are not available or not readily available to our time as to the world total for processing of ferrous scrap. Those figures are simply not readily available. The South African figure is 2.5 million tons a year of ferrous scrap and approximately 300,000 tons of non-ferrous scrap per year. We do, however, have the figure of the worldwide total for ferrous metal as a whole, and that is the 1 billion tons per annum. But of course, of that, a considerable proportion, both internationally and locally, is derived not from virgin metal, but from recycled metal. So the more that one can promote recycling in South Africa, the less burden there is on the environment in the form of mining, processing of raw ore, production of virgin metal, and the other pollutants and other environmental problems that we referred to earlier. Mr. Chairperson, I hope I've answered your question. May I then finally turn to the question that was posed just behind us from the side of the DDG. The exclusions that are referred to may well exclude the very small operators such as the peddlers and some of the small-scale bucket shops from the requirements of compliance with the bill. But the problem still remains that they too are affected by the cost distortion. Now, if the larger operators, the scrap merchants and the scrap processors, are subjected to regulation which inevitably will involve very considerable costs to them, that cost will inevitably be passed on to or shared with the operators down the line, including the bucket shops and the peddlers. So the problem is if, say, a scrap merchant operating, say, 15 vehicles specifically for scrap metal is now required to register each of those vehicles, to have tracking devices in respect of each vehicle, to employ environmental officers, etc., to deal with such matters, and then incur such costs, the inevitable effect is that's going to cut that operator's margins, and he or she will then pass on that to an extent down the line. It will mean that peddlers and bucket shops are paid less. If they are paid less, fewer of them are going to be collecting the same volumes, and instead that metal will lie around rusting or have to land up in a landfill, and that surely will ironically defeat the purposes of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Of course, the question that I asked about what happens to something to metal, scrap metal that you pick up but is not good. Are you saying that every picked up piece of metal by definition is not good?
No, I'm sorry if I didn't answer that fully. The definition that we propose is specific to be excluded. The scrap metal must A, have a value, and B, must be disposed of or collected for purposes of processing, reuse, recycle, or recovery.
What the point I'm trying to say here is that you can say when you get to the fair club, what do they want to sell it, but no one buys it, and you are saying that intention is enough to define it as not scrap metal. So I'm saying, what happens if the intention is not fulfilled by the market? Then what products do we have? Or I would say that there's so much demand that any piece of metal that any sector has, by definition, is already sold.
Yes, in reality, as I understand it, no peddler will pick up and collect a piece of metal without intending to have that sold for purposes of recycling. He's not going to store it in his backyard till kingdom come. If he does, if he's holding it no longer for purposes of processing, recycling, reuse.
Is every piece of metal that we have
by definition have a short market. That's the point I want to ask you.
Yes, I'm told that every type of metal does indeed have a market, and what the amendment to the definition is aimed at is only those items that have a value and that are disposed of or collected for purposes of processing, reuse, recycling or recovery. If that objective is not fulfilled, and it then does sit in the backyard of that peddler because he cannot find a market for it, it then becomes waste.
Thank you very much. Okay,
it seems to me there's no transformation at all as far as what do they call themselves? Metal Recyclers Association. And the next time they come here, it will take them longer than now to go out of this hall if you are not transformed. You have got to see females among you, not just men. So next time it's going to take you longer than today to leave this
house. On that note, thank you very much. We will continue. We will not be having a break. We're putting up until 2 o'clock. Yeah. You can be excused. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, is there not joint sitting in the
chamber? We will break for the joint sitting at 2. So we leave the public hearing at 5 to 2. So let's continue. If a member can just grab the sheets of energy and they go to the office. Otherwise, we've got to manage time.
Could we now invite the National African Farmers Union and the South Deben Community Environmental Alliance, Mr. Mike Abukelezi and Desmond Issa, on this issue?
Is Mr. Buchelet here? Huh? Are you ready, sir?
Amalungu onke ahloniphekile nakozakwethu ngithanda ukuthatha leli thuba ukuthi ngilibingelele.
The Honourable Chairperson and the Honourable Members of this House, I take this opportunity to come and present my presentation that is in front of me right now. Thank you.
The main issue here is the African stockpile or waste or agricultural waste that I'm going to deal with in terms of the deal that is in question. First of all, I come from the National African Farmers Union, which works in partnership with other organizations, looking at social, economic issues, also environmental issues inclusive. I have there the Vice President and the founder of NAFU, KZN, and I've done a lot of work in these issues and well traveled.
I believe that the farm members were concerned about food. People can go eat outside and pick up something and eat, but they were not going
to
attend.
There's nothing to pick up.
Okay, we will adjust that colleagues.
Thank you, Chair. The problem, as you can see on this slide, is that there are a lot of these stockpiles of pesticides that are lying around in the storage facilities of farmers, in their backyards, in their homes. And the critical issue here is that most of these farming communities, particularly the black farmers and their communities, are not aware of the danger of these stockpiles. And the issues obviously today is the question of what are these problems on the ground that you are talking about, and why is there a need to have a special mention of this agricultural waste or chemicals in the waste management field, and what do we need to do to ensure that incineration is not the process to deal with in terms of this ASP waste, both past and present and future, and why we feel that we don't have to incur any additional cost, but the producer or the sender of this waste must take full responsibility. If you look at the problem, as I have just said, there are many of them that are sitting with stockpile on their properties and in their house, and that is affecting a lot of rural communities. For the containers are used for water containers, and a lot of this waste or containers are dumped often illegally. I mean, the Moy River situation, particularly this year, is one that we can make mention of, and many others. The key here as an issue is that, you know, waste that is there is a problem because people are not aware of. They have not been educated, and even baseline studies have not been done to see the extent of a problem. And as we have heard from the banks and many others, soil as well as water is contaminated. And that presents a serious problem, as we have heard from the banks. As farmers, we are going to lose money, or we are not going to be even recognized, and it's going to affect our requests or loans at the banks, as you can see. And the research that has been done by Dr. Mohamed Akhil Dalvi and Dr. Neff in 1995 and 2003 will show that there is a problem. And also there is a problem with disposal, because not everybody can collect and dispose of these pesticides. It needs a special skill that we don't have. Therefore, even if they are collected to a central point, repacked, and all that needs a special skill and cost implications, overseas shipment, etc., and the final destruction is very costly. And we are saying that We don't feel that incineration is the answer. We can look at other non-incineration methodologies. If you look at this slide, you see that the pesticides are in direct contact with the floor, and pesticide spills are very visible. And in this slide, you would see that pesticides are stored outside, and if the access is allowed, but you can see, it's a very bad way of storing pesticides. Here you can see that pesticides are stored inside the house. However, there are empty containers outside, lying around, presenting a problem even to the families of the farmers as well. On this slide, you can see the condition of pesticide holders. Some of them are damaged and unclosed. Now, if you look at the results of this research by Stellenbosch, it was found out that 8% of the farms were in 1995 having pesticides still on site. 69% of these farms had unwanted pesticides and had accumulated further stock of obsolete pesticides since 1995, despite the retrieval project that I've just spoken about. And that 75% of the farms had no obsolete pesticides in 1995. Therefore, reported in 2003 of the obsolete pesticides. 50% of the farms which were not participating in 1995 in 2005 were reported to have had obsolete pesticides. In total, the quantity of obsolete pesticides has grown from 6.4% to 9.7%. So they are. If you look at the safe and hygiene of the pesticide stored, according to the Stellenbosch survey in 2000, the number of farms that were surveyed were about 68. Of the 68, 4% were storing pesticides in an unlocked facility, others with broken window and contaminated floor, 67%, pesticide packed disorderly, 40%, and up to 24% were unwanted pesticide mixed with clothing. The problem. Now, what are our positions? As a coordinator of the South African Pesticide Network, you know, as early as 2005, we were very vocal, rejecting the possibility of constructing disposal facilities within Africa. And we have also committed to actively encouraging alternatives to incinerate. That was a decision taken in Morocco, where almost all the five regions of Africa were involved, from South, North, East, West, and Central Africa. But there is still an ongoing push to use cement kilns to ban these agricultural pesticides. I think my other colleagues have mentioned the problems that we can encounter with this kiln banning. Therefore, the African, including South Africa, cement industry, does not have appropriate proven expertise to ensure that one, effective and appropriate storage, handling and processing of obsolete stockpile or hazardous waste will be provided in order to conform to the best international standards, and ensuring that the safety of its workforce, the environment and public health is protected in handling hazardous waste. Also, we, as our standpoint, we continue to say that the stockpile should be shipped back to the country from which they were donated and disposed of. There shouldn't be our problem. And I think we've heard from the bank. They want to shift the blame to us as farmers. We are going to be penalized. We are going to be let down. We are not going to be financed in the near future. But what about those multinational companies that brought all these pesticides to us as donations and all? Because that was discussed as donations, and we're happy not knowing that this is a problem. So we are concerned that even the DIT is continuously using the consultants that are pushing the burning of waste instrumentally, such as Kareka Castenson, who has worked with the World Business Council on Sustainable Development in their push burn waste instrumentally. As our standpoint also is, it's obviously no to incineration of ASP waste in cement. And we're saying that agricultural chemical or waste must be mentioned specifically in the waste management field. Ngabanyamazi, Salo, Namalunga Shuntunile, Parliament, the city, sicela thina kube nesigatshana nje esizophathisa kahle kulomthetho ukuthi le nkucuza le eyalahlwa lapha nekhutshekwayo ilahlwa laphana ey'ndaweni zethu sithengisela yona noma kuthiwa siyasizwa njengabantu abahluphekayo ikakhulukazi njengabalimi abasathuthuka bengasundisi ibungozi balezi zinto asiphathise kulomthetho esibona ukuthi muhle lami ngoba uzokusukela kwezemvelo. Kodwa uma siwubheka lo mthetho asiboni kukhona isigaba nje la kungase kubekwe nje embava nje kucacwe nje okwenazohlanya ukuthi sacaca. Umthetho uthi ukuze nezephulamthetho lezi sikwazi ukuthi uma umthetho siwuphasile sibhekane nazo siyisebenza sicacise nje ngokusobala ukuthi le nto uma zisidayisela zona noma zisilethela zona lapha emakhaya ikakhulukazi ngoba kwaziwa ukuthi azali. Bazobe sebesifundisile ukuthi la makhemikhali noma lo poison muhle uma ungemuhle unomgozi kuphi ukuze sabe. Kodwa-ke uma sekuney'nkinga awakuthatha phelipheli sekumva umthetho ucacise kahle ukuthi olethile inkinga hhayi akabizane nayo. Kuye kuthiwe-ke when you have made a mess you must clean up. Nabo sitabaklini njengoba kuyibona bahlele thina sasilima ngey'ndlela ey'ndala singenankinga. Lokhu sasiyabuka nje kulinywa kahle ngemiquba engasikhathazi ngalutho, kulinywa ngamakhemikhali, silima ngey'ndlela ezinhle. Nalezi zifo esey'bona ukuthi ziyahlongozwa ngoba ngeke sikusize kakhulu ngoba nabo opoisoni abanye babo balokuphi. Akho umthetho ufuna ukuqala ukuthi impela nje ukuthi umuntu oletha le nto kithi ekhatha ngokuthi ngoba singaba se-Afrika singabantu abangalutho, umthetho awubhekane naye uselekelele noma nathi silwa siyinhlangano kodwa phela lo mthetho ubukhona esilwela phekwawo. Ilokho nje umphathisalo ohloniphekile namalungu ephalamende esikubekayo thina singubuthwana oyinhlangano zezolimo eningizimu Afrika. Thank you.
Chairperson and the honourable members.
Unless you are translating for everyone else, the members who are here remaining head in proper. Unless one shares the information with them. Maybe because the benefit of your audience can come next.
Although it was too lengthy, I just to make a summary. Chairperson and the honourable members, what we wish to say as the listener, as the farmers you know, we just want to say that we plead that the section in the bill should be put in the bill, the section that will make a clarity about us as farmers, as to what should we do if we get those people who bring these stockpiles to us and they do not take them away from us. And we plead that we must be educated about this management of waste in South Africa, because previously we did have our own subsistence farms in our homes where we were able to use our natural fertilizer. There were no such poisons. These chemicals were not there. So we plead that there should be a real clarity in the bill that will help us to go through this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll make a slight change in the program. I think it's fair that we invite Dr. Lotta.
Thank you, Chair, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen. As I've indicated, Business Unity South Africa is a confederation of business associations. We probably represent 80 to 90% of the private sector contribution to the gross domestic product. We find the bill a very useful piece of legislation in that it provides us with a for the first time with a consolidated approach to waste management. We made extensive comments from the published version. We engaged with the department on it. Many of the concerns that we had on the published version have been addressed. However, we still have some concerns remaining. We think that it's important for requirements, particularly for this kind of bill, to specify the performance that we must achieve. What is the environmental outcome that we need to achieve? And not necessarily to try to prescribe technical solutions. The decisions by the Minister and NECs should be based on risk assessments. We always understand that that is government's approach to the type of legislation that we'd like to see it reflected in the bill. We remain committed as an organisation to working with government on implementation. We believe that the implementation of this bill is going to present very significant challenges. The issues of concern that we have still are around definitions, share the matter of alignment with other legislation policies is a matter that is always of concern to us. We'd like to say a few things about the role of the private sector. We also have some concerns around the transfer of land. The implementation of the bill is one of our biggest concerns, and we'll deal with a little bit of transitional provisions and compliance with international obligations and regulatory impact assessments. Now, see, if we look at the definitions that we have where we have concerns are the use of the term acceptable exposure. It's a difficult term. We had problems with it in our original submission. We still have problems with it, and we notice that it's only used in the case of contaminated land, and we think that the contaminated land could just as well be dealt with without reference to this definition, but it doesn't take into account the risk of a particular situation. The definition of disposal appears to us to include thermal disposal, although clearly we are reading it differently from other people who seem to think that it does include thermal. So I think it's clear there needs to be a clarification of that definition. General waste is defined in terms of not being hazardous, and it refers to an immediate hazard. We think as soon as you refer to an immediate hazard, you immediately must ask yourself what is then the long-term hazard. So it would be better not to use the term immediate hazard. I think it leads to an interpretation problem. Hazardous waste, we've always had a problem with the definition. The definition now, although improved, is still problematic. We think that really what we want to be saying here is that any waste that as a result of its composition has a detrimental impact on health and environment is hazardous. It's simple. Of course, we have to do significant classification exercises to get the subclass of hazards, but that we understand would be dealt with in regulations. So we think that the definition should be simplified, and everybody knows what hazardous is. See, we also have some difficulties still with the definition of waste. And I think that really what we might want to do is to see whether the European Commission directive on what waste is could not be used to better advantage in the bill. Because we've heard a long explanation from the metal recyclers in respect of generally the point that it is something that has been discarded. The holder doesn't want it anymore and it's therefore been discarded. That is what waste is. Waste management activity, here too we have two problems. We don't believe that import and export per se is a waste management activity. It means the transboundary movement of material, whether it's waste or not. We believe it should be in the bill, it must be regulated in terms of the bill, but we don't think it must be regulated as an activity that requires a license in terms of the schedule. And the way it's defined links you to the schedule and to the section dealing with licensing. So we think it may be better to say that, sorry Chair, that should be may not be imported. May not be imported or exported except in accordance with regulations in terms of 69J, which deals with this matter. So we think there must be a restriction on the transboundary movement, deal with it in regulation, and don't leave us hanging that it's a waste management activity. As far as generation is concerned as a waste management activity, this is a matter of grave concern to us, because while we recognize that it's not currently listed in the activities in the schedule which require a license, the way the bill is drafted and refers to waste management activities and even generation specifically, the potential is there for us to require a license from generation. That would mean that every single production process would require a waste management license, and we really don't think we don't think it's useful. The kind of activities that we're talking about, which I assume the department would want to regulate, require licenses in terms of other environmental legislation. So we think serious consideration should be given to removing generation from the definition of this activity. Then, Chair, if we look at alignment, and here we must really compliment the department, because this was a very, very serious concern of ours in the original draft, and significant effort has been made to address the concerns that we have, to try to make sure that the bill still covers those areas that it should cover, but at the same time not duplicate the requirements that we face under other legislation. We think under Section 14, where there's reference to the national economy, we think that to qualify the economy in that way just leads to interpretation difficulty. All aspects of whether it's a economy at local level, a rural economy, provincial economy, all of it is the economy of the country. And it's better then if one just speaks about the economy. Section 25, subsection 1 and 5, deals with the transportation of waste. We've raised this matter before. We really believe that there's further room for improvement in making sure that the obligations that we have under the transportation, the law, laws of the Department of Transport on transportation, there could be further alignment, particularly in the case of hazardous waste. We've also heard from the metal recyclers about the cost of registration at local level. Now, that registration system is in place in a number of local authorities, not in terms of this bill, but in terms of the Municipal System Act, which allows them to promulgate bylaws on a wide range of issues. And of course, to an extent, waste management is constitutionally assigned to local authorities. So here we have a situation where a national bill, which we think is appropriate, because we think that it's appropriate for these things to be dealt with nationally, provides a framework for dealing with the transportation of waste, yet local authorities have already got a quite comprehensive system in place which is not harmonized from municipality to municipality. So if you transport from one municipality to another, you have to comply with more than one requirement. It's very, very problematic. So we would prefer to see it in this bill, and then that all local authorities are harmonized as a result. But we believe that there is further room for alignment with the Department of Transport legislation. Section 36, we appreciate now the provision for consultation with Department of Water Affairs and Forestry. It's another area where there's possibilities of non-alignment. The section dealing with licensing, Chair, we recognize that progress has been made in this regard, and we also, in our submission in respect of the NEMA amendment previously, indicated our appreciation for the approach that we would try to look at integrated licenses, we would try to avoid duplication. However, neither, we of course haven't seen the final version of the EIA regulation, but the current version that we have seen, the listing of the Waste Management Act activities is not identical to the listing in the court. And we believe that in order to prevent confusion, they must be identical. So we would be quite happy to accept the listing as we have it in the bill, provided that the regulations before they finalize would then be brought into line, so that we can make sure that there is that absolute alignment. The department uses the term equivalent. Equivalent doesn't mean necessarily the same. We would want them to be the same. Here we believe that as far as the private sector is concerned, that we, particularly in the area of recycling, reuse, recovery, we have made a significant contribution. If one looks at the private sector, the current recycling initiatives, they are all operated by the private sector with minimal intervention by the state. We therefore would like to be sure that that good work that the private sector is doing is not undermined by what this bill does. We recognize, however, that there is a very significant role for the state in further extending the reach of recycling. And other speakers have made proposals in that regard, all of which we support. But we wouldn't want to have a situation where that those initiatives that are currently working well are reduced as a result of the application of the bill. Many of these of the subsectors that are engaged in recycling have some form of agreement now with the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism, and we would like those to be recognized and perhaps supported the status of industry management plans as provided for in the bill. What we are concerned about, and I was pleased that other speakers also recognize the importance of incentives and disincentives. We think particularly in managing waste that's something that needs to be given much greater attention in the bill. We were disappointed that the bill doesn't really provide in any detail at all for a mix of regulatory instruments. It's very strong on command and control, but not at all strong on incentives or disincentives. There's an award, Chair, which is specifically mentioned, but all of the references to incentives are in regulation. And here, when we speak about the regulations, we must know that there is no compulsion on the minister whatsoever to promulgate any regulations under that section. In other parts of the bill, certain things he must do, but he doesn't have to promulgate any regulations. There's also no time frame for him to promulgate regulations. So he may never do that. Certainly not in my lifetime. So we would want to see something more clearly defined in the bill. The matter of the minister declaring priority waivers was a matter of great concern to us, because that can be very costly. The consultation with the affected sectors, we feel is a great improvement, and we welcome that. We were concerned, Chair, we were surprised, really, I think, and perhaps it's something that we don't understand, but Section 27 previously made provision for private land owners to make provision for litter containers, but also municipalities. Municipalities have now been removed, and we find that a little bit strange. You know, maybe there's something there we don't understand, but we thought that is something that they should do. Now, Chair, if we come to implementation, where really the bulk of our problem lies, there is no doubt that framework legislation is extremely challenging. Because as an affected sector of society, we are not clear exactly what is going to be required of us. So in that sense, we prefer not to see framework legislation. But we understand also that it can be useful, because it allows you, in a very concise piece of legislation, to deal with a number of matters. But we think we need to then balance that usefulness against what you actually require to be able to meaningfully implement the bill. We had the same experience with the Air Quality Act, where at the time that this committee was considering that bill, we indicated that we were concerned that the bill would be difficult to implement, because a number of the technical requirements and the regulations that were required for implementation were not part of the bill. At that time, we were given the assurance that there would be a national air quality framework produced as required by the bill, and it would deal with all these matters. 2 years has now passed. We now do have that document, but it doesn't deal with all the matters. Now we sit with a new framework law on waste, and it requires a national waste management strategy to be produced by the minister in 2 years, and we fully expect that he will do that. However, the key elements that you need to implement this bill are norms and standards. If we don't have the norms and standards, it's just not possible, because there's no quantitative outcome that somebody who's undertaking a waste management activity must adhere to. And there's no time frame for the norms and standards. They're not part of the National Waste Management Strategy, they're part of a separate section of the bill, and there's no time frame. So the minister could take 5 years to produce them. So we think that is something that really needs very serious attention. We think, Chair, and I realize that this may be radical, and I'm not a lawyer, so maybe it's a ridiculous approach, but we think that the sections of the bill that require regulation, that clearly require regulation and norms and standards, should only enter into force once that necessary underpinning is there. Because otherwise you have a bill which there's an expectation from our side that we must try and comply with it, that we get a different story from each province, for example. We don't really know what the requirements are. There's an argument about the interpretation. You want to see the norms and standards imposed. So for us, we would say two things need to be done. Deadlines must be imposed for norms and standards to be produced, and those sections of the bill that require these norms and standards should only come into force once the regulations are enforced, or the norms and standards. We think a work plan in this regard should be developed and made public. This is not necessarily, Chair, obviously part of the bill, but we think it would be important for a work plan to be developed, made public, and to allow all stakeholders to engage around that plan. another area where we've got a difficulty, Chair, and this is not because we oppose it in principle. The bill requires that if we would undertake recycling, recovery, reuse, we must demonstrate that doing that uses less resources than disposal. In order to demonstrate that, you have to essentially do a life cycle assessment. We don't oppose that in principle, but we think it should be removed from the bill and dealt with in regulations which make it clear how we can demonstrate that we would use less resources. If it's left in the bill, in our view, it seems to us that existing recycling and recovery and reuse activities may be compromised because we're not able to demonstrate that, and there's not a clear set of rules how we should demonstrate it. So we think that needs further consideration. Chair, I realize that others don't necessarily like this idea of reasonable grounds and so on, but we prefer to see that if the minister is going to make a decision to impose a regulatory burden on industry, he must have reasonable grounds to do it. He must be able to say, this is why I'm doing it. And there's a number of sections in the bill where that is not required. In some sections it's required, in some not. In other environmental legislation it is required, in this one it's not consistently required. Other areas, Chair, in some cases of licensing we're required by the bill, we may be required by the bill to appoint an independent person. We say that if we don't oppose that, but we're saying it's important to understand what the circumstances are under which we should appoint such a person. And you need a regulation to do that unless you deal with it in the bill, and it's not dealt with in the bill. So we think it needs to be subject to regulation. We have the same difficulty as was raised on the public consultation requirement in respect of Section 28.7. What is appropriate? We would prefer to see that what is appropriate is set out in regulations or binding guidelines of some type. So I think we would want to see that section is qualified in that way. The same, there's also in Section 46, the licensing requirement, also a further appointment of independent person. Again, we believe it should be subject to regulation setting out the circumstances. Then, Chair, in respect of the transfer of facilities, we are concerned about the use of the term ownership of a license. We think it's a difficult word when you're talking about the license, and stakeholder may be a better word. When we already, Chair, and this committee may not be aware of that, we already, when transferring property, are subject to a number of technical requirements from other regulators. We must give an electrical certificate. We now have to, in terms of new legislation, we have to give a more comprehensive electrical certificate. There's other certificates that we have to give. Here now we would have to get a further. And we think that it may be useful to have a discussion with the deeds office or whoever is appropriate to make sure that there's a practical regulation in this regard. We're not opposed to having to do it, but we're saying let's look if we can't make sure that we've got a practical way of doing it which suits the requirements of the use office, the conveyancing attorneys, and then also suits the requirements of the department. And this is again an area where the public participation requirements need to be described in regulation where a license is transferred. Then, Chair, this is a long-standing disagreement that we have with the department. This bill deals not only with waste. It deals with products that could become waste. So, in other words, the bill goes to the heart of the production process and the quality of the product. So it doesn't wait for that product to become waste. It says, I want to tell you how you must produce it so that you minimize the waste as you produce it. That kind of argument. We don't disagree that that is something that the world could deal with. But we say when you deal with product, then you have to comply with the World Trade Organization agreement on technical barriers to trade, which says that, it sets out a whole set of principles of how you deal with this kind of regulation, because it goes to the heart of trade. So we may regulate the product in South Africa for a perfectly legitimate reason. As soon as a person imports that product from another country which may not have that law, if that product comes into South Africa, they must comply with our law. But they need to understand that and have had the opportunity also to engage with that law. And therefore we have to comply with this agreement. So in those cases where the bill does take a step of saying there must be consultation with the Minister of Trade and Industry, we appreciate that. But we wanted to be clear about that, that that is not a sufficient action. There must also be compliance with the WTO requirements. Then, Chair, this of course, the matter of regulatory impact assessment is a matter that Business Unity South Africa has been discussing with the government over a long period of time. And we are very pleased that this matter is now part of the government program of action, that the regulatory impact assessment system will be implemented. And the most recent information we have is that the deadline set out in the program of action for December 2008 will in fact be met, and that this is halfway to cabinet. Now, when we were discussing this bill with the department, a commitment was made that a cost-benefit analysis would be undertaken. There's a memorandum attached to the bill which refers to the fact that the regulatory impact assessment was undertaken. What we have before us in the memorandum is not a regulatory impact assessment. It is a cost. It's an analysis of the cost to the state. It doesn't set the cost to the state even against the benefits that the state will achieve, except in a very general sense in saying that there's an anticipation that the cost of waste management will decrease after the fifth year, I think. It doesn't take into account the cost to industry at all. In other words, the cost to the economy is not shown at all. And we recognize, while we would have preferred that the cost-benefit analysis would have been done on this bill before it is finalized, we recognize that that may be a step too far, but we would like to see a commitment that all the regulations will be subject to regulatory impact assessment and check out in the program of action. Then, Chair, if I can conclude, we welcome the bill as a consolidated approach. As discussed, we think there are some drafting improvements which we hope you'll be able to consider. Implementation must be supported by the necessary norms and standards. We shouldn't have to attempt to comply with it without those standards being in place. Regulatory impact assessment. And once again, Chair, we would like to reiterate our commitment to working with government, the committee, in developing the necessary norms and standards and in whatever way we can support the implementation. I think it's an important piece of legislation that's worth doing, making the effort to make sure that it works. And we think that if we take the time in developing the necessary norms and standards, then we won't regret having supported the bill at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lota. I welcome your contribution as well as the issues that are raised in the recommendation. We'll apply our money to them. At this stage, I am tempted to say that this agenda, and then we will come back at 3 o'clock. I think there is some free finger lunch outside. The people should empower themselves. We will attend, we have got to attend the first parliament. The president has an important issue from us. So we'll be back at 3 o'clock. Thank you very much. Thank you.